Non-consumptive.
There you go.
I'm David Gordon. I represent the BLM.
This guy is coming to Dan Abeda. He's with the Forest Service, and he's going to be about 30 minutes late, but he will join us.
Did you say who you were?
I did. I introduced myself right off the bat.
I'm Boyd Blackwell, and I'm the executive secretary.
Mitch Hacking, and I'm representing agriculture.
Andrea Merrill, and I'm also representing non-consumptive.
Joe Arnold, and represent public.
Okay, thank you. Let's kind of go over a little bit about the way we do this. We're going to first, when we get started, we'll have a presentation by the division, and then we've got some comment cards, which we'll talk about in a minute. But we've got after the division recommendation, there'll be some questions. We'll have questions. We'll ask the rec members if they have any questions, and after that we'll ask the public if they have any questions. And if you have a question, please step up to the mic, state your name, and ask your question. That is not a time for comments. It's just a time for questions on the presentation. The comments will be coming a little bit later after all the questions are asked. Then we'll go to the comment period, and you'll be given, when you give a comment, we do need one of these from you if you're going to get up to the mic and state your name and ask a comment or give your comments. We will want you to fill out one of these, so please do that. And you do have 3 minutes to give comments, and we've asked our secretary here to kind of keep track of that so we don't run over time. So please, we're kind of trying to do this like the Wildlife Board does it. So when you go to their meetings, you got 3 minutes, so we're going to give 3 minutes of our meetings too. So, but if you have any comments and you haven't filled out one of these, they're right on the outside on the table. Please fill one out. You can either bring it up here or give it to Rory or somebody over here at the table over here, and they'll shuffle it up to us. All right. We'll get going with our meeting tonight. We'll start off with the approval of the minutes. Has everybody had a chance to review the minutes? We have a motion to approve them. Of the November minutes?
I make that motion to approve the new minutes, the way they were labeled as new minutes that Boyd had sent out.
Okay, that was made by Brett Prevedel. We have a second?
I'll second it.
David Gordon has a second. All those in favor? Thank you. Any opposed? We're good. All right. We will ask the RAC members tonight to be sure and speak into the mic. So if you're going to talk, I move this a little bit closer, but be sure and hold that mic up to you and talk good so that we get it on the recording. Sometimes we talk a little bit mild, and if the mics are a little bit further away, we don't get it on the recording of what we've talked about, and we want to kind of do the best we can there. So let's see, jumping into the agenda for tonight. We need to approve the agenda. We have a motion to approve the agenda, or any changes to the agenda? Entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the agenda.
Okay, that was made by Joe Batty. Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
Melissa Wardell has a second. All in favor? It is unanimous. Thank you. Well, let me give you a little bit of an update on the Wildlife Board meeting. They had a board meeting last Friday. For the November stuff, and just give you an idea of what they talked about there. Director Sheehan talked a little bit about the prairie dogs. I missed just a little bit of the meeting because of the weather was a little bit nasty, and getting out of town here that day, it took us a little bit longer to get there than we'd planned, but the roads worked real good. But he talked a little bit about the prairie dog hunting and the current concern with using lead bullets on that. There's some discussion going on there now at a little bit around the possibility of requiring you to pick up the carcass afterwards, but then the concern there is spreading the plague around, so they're talking about not doing that, but they're trying to figure out how to allow prairie dog hunting and keep it going and not to leave the lead bullets around. So, you know, there's a little bit of discussion about that, just to understand there's nothing's decided on that, but they are discussing that. And then they talked about the elk unit plan revisions. And there was some concern there voiced by a few of the cattlemen across the state of the wildlife and the amount of feed that's out there for both the livestock and the wildlife, and they just want to make sure that they don't get their numbers cut on the Forest Service or on the land itself. So that was basically the biggest concern over the elk unit management plan there. It was that was passed as the division presented. The next topic that they talked about was the bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime season dates and application timelines. And one thing the division proposed that was taken out of it was the 7-day archery extension. That portion of the presentation did not get passed. But they did, if you remember, the Utah Bowman's Association wanted 6 additional hunts, and they did get 2 of those. One was a mountain goat hunt on the Uintas here, on the North Slope, South Slope, and High Uinta Central. And the other archery hunt only will be on it'll be a bison on the Henrys. Those two did get passed as part of that topic. Then the next topic was the preference point system amendments. And if you remember right, that was where they were going with your first choice first as far as your preference points, whereas before and you lose your preference points if you draw a tag. And that one did get passed as the division presented it. The Northeastern Unit Deer Management Plans, where there's raising some of the objectives on the deer herds here in our area, that passed unanimous. The CWMU management plan also passed with a condition that one of the CWMU operators in the Deer Creek area, that they come and prove to the division that they're the public hunters on those CWMUs are happy. Evidently, there's been some issues in the past, and they want to make sure that the public hunters that they get a hunt on that property are being satisfied. The last thing was landowner association permit numbers, and passed as presented unanimously also. So that's kind of an update from the Wildlife Board last week. With that, we'll turn the time over to Boyd for a regional update.
Thank you. A lot of you have heard from time to time here in the RAC and some of the public where I've talked about our awesome habitat section and the work that they do around the region. And I've asked them tonight if they wouldn't come and give a little presentation on some of the things that they've done this last year. And what I'll do is I'll introduce you here to Miles Hanberg. He's our manager in the region, and he has a staff, and I've asked him if he wouldn't mind introducing his staff, and they take up a bunch of the row in the back there. So, but Miles, if you wouldn't mind addressing.
Miles is a big guy. He takes up quite a space anyway.
Yeah, that's a little low. Maybe I'll start off and just kind of give you guys a brief overview of what the habitat section does for the Division of Wildlife Resources. There's kind of 3 main areas that we deal in. One of those is kind of habitat improvement, those types of projects. The second thing is we do own a fair amount of land, so we spend quite a bit of time trying to manage the land we own. And then the last thing is we do a fair amount of impact analysis, what we call, just to try to work with development to make sure that we can kind of minimize or offset impacts that some of these projects may have to wildlife. So I'll give a brief overview, and then I'll have some of the guys come up and give you some more examples and some things that's been going on the last couple of years, and they have some good information for you. So I won't spend too much time talking and let those guys give some more information. But just in about the last 10 years through our habitat work, we've completed, we're closing in on about 150,000 acres. That includes work through partnerships with some of the federal and private land managers. But a lot of that's completed through our WRI program from the Department of Natural Resources, as well as UWR's Habitat Council program as well. We also participate on a lot of fire rehab projects. One example is up here at the Paler Mountain area that burned a few years ago. We worked with BLM to do some rehab work on that and get something that would sustain wildlife in the future. Along the habitat lines, we also do a lot of guzzler work. For those of you who don't know what a guzzler is, it's basically a water catchment put to catch water. We have about 195 of those in this region right now. It's mostly big game. But the last couple of years, we've been pretty proactive on developing guzzlers. We've developed about 30 of them last year alone. So that's about another 40,000 gallons of water that's available out there on the landscape for some of our wildlife. In this region, we also have about 27 wildlife management areas, and that's about 168,798 acres. That's a pretty big job to manage that much land, but it's scattered from the Fruitland area clear to the Colorado line. So one of the neat things is our Tabby Mountain WMA. That's the largest WMA in the state. It's about 46,000 acres. That's really neat to be able to manage work with a big piece of property like that. We can do some good things on a piece of property that big. But a lot of this property was acquired through mitigation projects from the Colorado Storage Project, mainly Clayton Gorge, and also the Central Utah Project. They were offsetting impacts to big game on some of those development projects. And the last thing with impact analysis, we spend quite a bit of time, especially when oil and gas development's busy, try to look at minimizing offsetting impacts. But recently, some of these large power transmission lines that are proposed to come through the area, we've been working on some of those projects. And then, a big issue in the state for deer herds is highways. And we've got Ben Williams will talk a little bit more about highways here in a little bit, but we've been able to complete the corridor assessment with UDOT in the area west of Duchesne. So as they do upgrades to that highway, hopefully we'll get some more wildlife mitigation in there to help avoid so many wildlife and deer collisions in that area. One of the other big ones has been Seep Ridge Road, and I'll let Ben discuss that a little bit more in the future. So with that, I'll let these guys spend a little more time. First up will be Tori Mathis. He's our habitat restoration biologist. Then we'll have Pat Rainbolt, he's the assistant habitat manager, and then Ben Williams, he's our energy project leader. So I'll turn the time over to those guys.
Thank you, Miles.
As Miles mentioned, my name is Tori Mathis. I'm the habitat restoration biologist. My main duties are to plan and implement large-scale habitat improvement projects. As part of that, I work with our local Utah Partners for Conservation and Development group to implement the Watershed Restoration Initiative. That picture that you see up there is one type of project that we do, usually called a bull hog, where we mulch pinyon and juniper trees that have encroached in the sagebrush habitats. But I thought perhaps the best way for me to show you what we do and have done is to get on here to the website, wri.utah.gov. This is the website of the Watershed Restoration Initiative. If you want to learn more about it, there's a link up here, this About Us, that takes you to a different page that has a couple of videos and the informational items about the initiative. But I want to go to the maps right now and just take a look at the kinds of things that we've done, not only in this region, but throughout the state. It pulls up a map of the state of Utah, and it's going to get busy putting on little dots. Each of those dots will represent the center point of a habitat project that's gone on somewhere in the state. So we're just going to zoom in. Well, that's, I don't want to do that. Maybe I can. So see if it'll zoom in on Sea Bridge. Doesn't look like it's going to. I'll just do it this way. So each of the different colors represent a different project status. The green ones are completed projects, the blue ones are current projects, and then the black ones, if there are any, are ones that were planned and then canceled for one reason or another. And if we zoom in here far enough, those dots change to polygons to show completed projects. This is one, we called it the Sea Bridge Bullhog, phase two. out there along the Sea Bridge Road, just going to click on this to highlight it. So you can see the project area. It was about a little under 400 acres in size. You can see the land ownership there. You can see the type of project that was done. It was a bullhog. We put seed on with it. You can also toggle on different areas to see the land ownership. There is a range trend site on this project, so you can there would be a dot there. We'll go over here to the project details page to learn a little bit more about it. It pulls up this page to show there's a title page. The original plan was to improve 475 acres of range by seeding and mechanically removing pinyon and juniper trees. Then I'll just, there are these different tabs that tell different things about it, if you care about the finances or some of the details or the seed. But I want to go over here to the images, because this is where it gets really fun, I think. We'll just click on one of these to see what it looked like before we did it and then after, so you get an idea of what we do. So this is, a bullhog is one of the more dramatic kinds of projects in terms of before and after pictures, because we usually start out with an area that it may still have some shrubs left. You can see some sagebrush and bitterbrush left over in that area, but it's being rapidly taken over by conifers, mostly pinyon pine and Utah juniper. And as those species increase in cover, the shrubs and the grasses decrease in cover. So you can see a couple of pictures of what it looked like before, and then sooner or later we get to the after picture. It's quite a difference, and the elk and the deer notice the difference too. There's a lot more feed on there. These are pictures from the Range Trend study site, and there is data available linked to this project on this page. If you're interested, you can get on and pull out all of the data and see exactly how much grasses and forbs and shrubs have increased and how much the conifers have decreased. It looks like I left an island kind of right in the middle of their transect. But that's just one type of project that we do. There are also there are a lot of others, removing pinyon and juniper trees on different densities. It may simply require a chainsaw. So we also do projects relating to riparian areas and wetland areas. Wherever we find a need of something that is threatened or needs improvement, we try to develop a plan and go in and make some sort of improvement. But that's my part of this. So we'll go on to Pat next, I believe.
Vince, we ask a question.
Sure.
Do you have the actual cost per acre of this brush hogging, and who pays the bill on it?
That is all on that website. You can get on any one of those.
I don't have a computer.
On any one of those tabs, you can pull up the budget that we put together. You can always come in also. In general, that they run anywhere, depending on the size of the trees, the density, the bullhog itself can run anywhere from $180 to $300 plus an acre.
Yes, the...
Where's the...
The WRI funding is made up of?
The WRI funding is... There's a lot of different pools of funding. A lot of it comes from the BLM, from the state, other federal agencies, conservation groups. Some of the funds that they get from selling hunting licenses go back into these watershed projects. That funds come from a lot of different places, and again, on that website, you can see exactly which groups and how much they spend on any one project. It's all public data on that website.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Pat Rainbolt. I'm the Assistant Habitat Manager here in the Northeastern Region. My duties are impact analysis. Like Miles mentioned, any major project that comes through the area, like these power lines or different projects, kind of give input for wildlife for those and the official stakeholders. My main duty is overseeing the maintenance of our WMAs in the region. As Miles mentioned, we have 27 properties in the region. They total over 160,000 acres. They range in size from 80 acres, the game farm here in town, to almost 50,000 acres at Tabby Mountain. We have these properties because they protect priority wildlife habitat. They provide public access, and there's a wide range of opportunity that these properties provide, from open game hunting to fishing access to big game hunting, and even we have properties with once-in-a-lifetime species opportunities on them. We do a lot of our projects on our WMAs in cooperation with the counties, dedicated hunters, scouts, Eagle Scouts can do some projects with the Eagle Scout. Adjacent landowners, we work with them a lot to when our projects might cross over the boundary lines. And volunteers. Some of the different projects we do to enhance the value of our WMAs. This is a browse seeding. We'll do this to seed different species of browse to benefit. Mainly in this area, you see it's dominated by grasses, which is good for elk. So we added in some browse seeding for wintering mule deer. And this was seeded with bitterbrush and four-wing saltbush. This is an example of a sagebrush harrow. You're looking down the row. You can see on the upper right and upper left, it's a little more dense, a little more decadent, older sagebrush that's at a higher density that's not as valuable for wildlife. So we'll take the chain harrow through and kind of bust it up a little bit and give it a little vigor and kind of open up the space a little bit for better wildlife use. Fencing. With 27 properties, you can imagine we have a lot of fencing. We work with the maintenance of that fence. We have all types of fencing that you can imagine, from total wood to T-post wire to this pipe fence. We work with a lot of the different production companies in the basin. A lot of our materials are donated, like with this pipe fence. We even get some volunteer welders to come and put those together for some dedicated hunter hours, some service time in that. The fencing helps control our boundaries. It helps keep vehicles on the road, which cuts down on erosion and noxious weed spread and just general degradation of the properties. Our noxious weed program is very good. We're required by law to manage these weeds on our properties, and we do a very good job of that. We cover our properties and keep a database of those, and visit every property every single year and control these weeds. Guzzlers, Ben's going to talk a little bit more about that. This is a guzzler we did on Bear Top. It collects water for wildlife, and this is Nate Bellison and his son. He's the county, Uinta County weed guy here in town, and his son got his Eagle Scout building this guzzler for us on one of our WMAs. Any questions about our WMAs or the management of those properties?
visited with Boyd about this the other day. Your fencing, when you guys
can
look through there.
Can you come up to the mic? Can you come up to the mic?
Singling me out on that one.
Yep.
All right, Jesse McKee, just a quick question on your fencing. Is there a certain specs you guys use for every fence, or is it all kind of different? I know we done was down in Meadow Creek, you guys went and done some work. Boyd filled me in on that. But on your that one you have with your pipe and your cable there, mm-hmm. your spacing, is there any math done on that when your elk and that are jumping to where they ain't getting tangled up in that? And if there is, we've found on different things we've done, and I actually recommend it down there on that one, you know, barbless wire on that top rail to where it's got a weak point in it, to where, you know, when they jump, they get their feet caught and twist up. Pretty common, really, in them fences. Is there break points you have in that? And if not, would a wireless barbless wire be better to put on that?
It is, and those are a lot of things that some research come about in the past decade to support exactly what you're talking about. And more wildlife-friendly design fencing, we like to keep the height of the top rail or the top wire at 42 inches as opposed to 48 inches, which was used a lot in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Smooth wire on the top. If we have a wire fence with T-posts, we usually do four strands of wire with a smooth on the top, so animals jumping over can have that smooth surface and smooth wire on the bottom as well, so any animals that go under, like a pronghorn or young deer that go through and have that smooth surface, so not easily snagged up on. And a lot of our fencing, like I said, we've got hundreds of miles of fencing, mm-hmm. so you can imagine there's a lot that still uses the old design, but when we go through and improve, we use that 42-inch height. We have a top rail where we can, and when we can't, when we have to use I guess less expensive methods, when we have a lot of miles to cover,
yep.
when we use T-posts and wire, we definitely use, there's a 6 to 8 inch spacing, so the legs aren't as likely to get tangled up if they miss that top wire. And then we use the smooth wire in the top and the bottom.
And that's contracted out to, you guys don't do the building the fences yourself, or do you?
We do some in-house. It depends on
how big of a
project it is. Some of our larger projects, we just can't take on. We don't have manpower and funds to do those, so it's done through the WRI process that Tori spoke about. We'll contract those out through that.
Just quick suggestion on some of that, and I can't remember if you said, you know, that old fence we talked about next to that down in that Meadow Creek farm on the other side, is that old fence still there?
They took it out, I believe.
I know what you're referring to.
You got that out?
We took that out this summer and we put crossings in.
Okay, no, that's what I was going to ask you, and you know, we would have, I think I visited my old ones as well. In the future on stuff, we would have probably gladly been able to do that pretty cost efficient with you guys on that, and I offered that, and I don't know what it costs to do either way, but we had the cows right there too, so we have the equipment and means to do that, and seen it was a problem for a while, but you know, maybe just asking the neighbors and us like that, we could probably assist you guys on some of the projects to take the cost off bringing people in when we're there. Vice versa, even if we was paid to do it, would have been probably cheaper to go in and help on that. But thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
You might want to stay with whoever's on.
Ben Williams, my Silas Energy Project leader. What I do is anything, as it says, anything oil and gas related, which in this region can at times be quite a bit, as we all know in the last little while, we haven't had quite as much. But I do all of the impact analysis that Pat was talking about for anything oil and gas related. And we work through projects, work a lot with the BLM when they're doing their NEPA analysis for energy projects, any pipelines, any of that stuff. That's kind of what I deal with. A couple of things I wanted to specifically talk about tonight. There we go. First off, Seabridge Road. I kind of got this one. Most everybody should know Seabridge Road. The county proposed this road to be paved about 7 years ago that process started. Started building at about 5. But as part of that process, we worked closely with the county, with the BLM. Part of the NEPA process, we got six wildlife crossings installed in that road during initial construction. We really wanted to get some fencing as well with these crossings. Funding and everything where the county road was a little short. So what we ended up with was these six crossings for now. We feel really good about that because the crossing would never go in if it didn't go in with the initial construction. So we got these six crossings. We've been monitoring them from the time they were constructed with the trail camera on each end of the crossing to monitor whatever what's using them. Wanted to throw up this picture. A little bit of a sample of what we've had go through the crossings. Pretty much every animal that you would think in the book lists would go through the crossing or may go through the crossing, we've had pretty much everything use these crossings. The only thing we haven't is a black bear. We haven't had any black bears go through these crossings, but you name it, everything else, they've used the crossings. So we're really excited about that. The crossings are obviously working. Point of interest down here on the lower left, you'll notice we've got bison that have gone through crossings. Pretty sure this is the first time that bison have ever used any sort of wildlife crossing to get across the highway anywhere, mainly because there's not many places with wild bison, but we can kind of take that as a notch, so to speak, that we've accomplished something that's not been done anywhere else. The crossings are working, but as I said, we don't have any fencing associated with these crossings on the Seabridge Road, so of course, we are still having some issues with the roadkill on Seabridge Road. We've been monitoring, that's part of my duties, has been monitoring this. I've been monitoring, what we've been doing is at least once a week driving the Seabridge Road to look for any roadkill and try to document that. So here's a graph showing what we've had since 2009. And to explain this a little bit, how we broke it up is because we're mainly worried about the winter range. So basically going from July 1 of 1 year to June 30th of the next year is the time period that we're monitoring. During the first 3 years, and this was pre-construction, you can see documented one deer and one domestic cow, interestingly enough, killed on the road. The 2012 to 2013 time period was when the construction was just initially getting going and they had some of the lower elevation paved. And then you can see as the paving was completed how those numbers have gone up. The 2016, 2017, obviously that's just from July 1 until today, those numbers. So I expect those to continue to rise. You know, by the time we get to July 30th next year, the Division of Wildlife is very concerned about this, and we're working with the county and trying to come up with solutions to try to minimize this amount of roadkill. Because everybody should know, you know, most roadkill it's mostly doe deer that are getting killed, which is part of your production on your herd, and we're concerned about the production on the bookless unit. So something we're watching, something we're trying to keep our keep ahead of, so to speak, as things go forward, because as many of you know, Buena County, their proposal and what they want to do is continue the road on down to I-70 up the south side. If that happens and traffic increases significantly, we would expect the roadkill numbers to go up significantly as well. Up to this point, the traffic really hasn't changed so much, just the speeds on the road. Jump over to Guzzlers real quick. I've been doing quite a bit of Guzzler stuff. Being the oil and gas stuff is not as prevalent as it has been the last couple of years, I've kind of got to do some more work to try to mitigate these impacts to wildlife, and we've been doing a lot of Guzzler work. This is an example of a Guzzler, though for those of you who may not have seen it. This is the style we've kind of switched to as of recently. The tank that you can see is kind of the dome top on that tank. These are called boss tanks. There's a drinker in the one corner where the animals can get to the water. The tank itself actually collects rainwater and snow melt. And then we add on these, what we call aprons, which is basically a metal roof, to collect rainwater and snow melt. These are 1,800-gallon tanks. So unless you've got a lot of critters using them, they're pretty much self-sustaining, and they're doing really well for us. Wanted to throw up this map of, these are Guzzler locations. Give you an example of, you know, how extensive throughout our region. The black outline is the northeast region, and these are just Guzzlers that we have to date. And we're continually trying to either go in and replace old guzzlers that aren't functioning, or continuing looking for additional places that the needs water. They're working really well. Just a few pictures here to kind of show you what's going on with the guzzlers. Obviously, antelope is the focus here. The antelope that you notice with the ear tags, those are antelope that were transplanted to our region from down on Parker Mountain. They're using the guzzler. They're working well. We've got a lot of deer use on guzzlers. Elk love guzzlers. Elk really, really seem to be benefiting greatly from the guzzlers we've been putting in. Bison on the book list. We've got bison using them. And pretty much, as I said, pretty much everything else you can imagine we have documented using guzzlers. But it's pretty neat. Just a few last pictures. I had to show some cool pictures so everybody didn't get too bored. But you can see we got moose. The moose are up on top of Bear Top on that guzzler up in Daggett County, and so are the elk and the bighorn sheep. But if we've got wildlife around the guzzler, they are usually these guzzlers, and I think we feel it's making a really big difference in a lot of our areas on how much wildlife we can actually sustain on the landscape. And with that, I'll just ask if there's any questions. Good, I didn't need questions.
Thank you, Ben.
So that's my habitat section, and I'm really proud of that group, and they do a lot of hard work. They didn't bring in the stinky, smelly, hard workers, so we're all lucky there. But these guys do a good job, and I want them to know that I really appreciate what they do. All back right. To you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. A lot of good stuff. Well, we'll kick it off with the waterfowl recommendation and rule amendments. Turn the time to Blair Stringham. Blair, if you wouldn't mind, pull that mic up where it can get up to your close to your mouth. Where? Is that as good as it gets?
Yeah, just take it out of here.
Okay.
Alright, so tonight I'll be presenting the 2017-2018 waterfowl recommendations. First, I just wanted to go over the habitat conditions from last year compared to this year. For the most part, things were similar. Really, the only major changes last year was things were a little bit drier throughout Alberta and parts of Saskatchewan and northern Montana, and that affects us here because a good portion of our birds actually come from that area. But outside of that, for the most part, things looked really well across the rest of Canada and Alaska. How that translates into bird numbers, you can see here that we're near record highs for our duck population. We're sitting just below 50 million ducks. And so because of those very good conditions across Canada and Alaska, it's reflected here in our duck numbers. If you look at the individual species, really the only species we have a lot of concerns with right now are northern pintails. You can see that they were down again this year, and they also are below their long-term average on that right-hand side. This year, they're sitting about 30% below their long-term average. So they are a species of concern, but everything else is sitting well above its long-term average. And so the way our duck season is put together, it's based upon how well our mallards are doing in the western part of North America. Because we had another strong mallard population again this year, we'll have a 107-day season next year and a bag limit of 7. We also have 3 species that have species-specific harvest strategies, so we look at them individually. And the only one that will change going into next year are going to be our pintails. Because they were down so far from this year and their long-term average, they dropped below a threshold where we can have a 2-bird bag. So next year, the highest we'll be able to have is a 1-bird bag. Looking at our other populations of waterfowl, our swamp populations continue to do really well in their flyway, as do our goose populations. Our Canada geese continue to do really well, both here locally in the state of Utah and across the Pacific flyway. And we've seen great increases as well in our light goose populations, our snow and Ross geese, as they continue to increase. So for our waterfowl recommendations this year, there's been growing interest in the southern part of the state to put together a waterfowl-specific zone for them. There's a lot of opportunities that can be gained by doing this. Overall, it could provide longer seasons for hunters who could hunt earlier in the northern part of the state and later in the southern part of the state, giving them more than 107 days to hunt ducks in our state. It also allows us to have two youth days and two general openers. These have been really popular in the past, and so we could now have one in the northern part of the state and one in the southern part of the state, which would give people two opportunities to participate in those. And generally, we see higher use and success on those 2 days. Really, the main focus for putting this together was because we've seen a lot fewer birds in the southern part of the state as our season's opened. We are kind of hoping to capitalize on opening the season later so we can hunt later and hopefully provide better hunting opportunities for hunters down there. And we can also modify our scop season so we can hunt scop longer in our state. So what we would be proposing for our duck zone would essentially be everything north of I-70, north of the Utah County border, and including DuSane and Utah County, or Uinta counties. That would be in the north zone. Everything south of there would be in the southern zone. And so the season dates for those areas, and the north zone would start on October 7th, and the southern zone would start a week later on October 14th. For our scop season, we'd start that on the opener in the northern part of the state and then start it to where we could have 86 days at the end of the season in the southern part of the state, so that would start on November 3rd. And the only thing that would change as far as our bag limits would be the pintail bag. Everything else would be the same from last year. The same for the coot, snipe, and falconry bags. For our goose zones, these would stay relatively the same from what they were last year, other than just with the addition of creating a southern goose zone. This would be the same boundary that we had for the duck zone, and we'd be able to do it the split there, so we'd start the same day the duck hunt opens and close the day the duck hunt closes. Everything else would essentially be the same other than the modifications we have to make to the northern zone to accommodate that southern zone. For our light goose seasons, and we'd have the similar season dates to what we had last year, as well as asking for a close in Millard County to accommodate the snow goose festival that occurs in Delta each year. For a swan hunt, these season dates would be similar to what they have been in the past, with the same hunt area and the same number of permits. And our youth day, with the two youth days, the first one to be in September 23rd in the northern zone, and then a week later in September 30th in the southern zone. Hunters that were 17 or younger on July 31st could participate in that. And anybody who did hunt that would have to have a mentor with them that was 18 or older, and youth older than 16 or older would have to have a duck stamp. As far as our rule changes this year, we're looking at adding a rest area to Ogden Bay. This is a waterfowl management area along the Wasatch Front, and the majority of our waterfowl management areas have a rest area that's designated for a place where ducks and geese and everything else can go and sit and not be impacted by hunting, as well as have people moving through this area. It generally translates into better hunting within that given area, and so this is the proposed area that we'd be looking to designate as a rest area at Ogden Bay. We'd also be looking to redefine the boundary for our learning center that we built at Farrington Bay. We're also looking at making some changes to our SWAN application. We currently don't allow youth hunters to apply as a group, so we're looking to allow that. We also hold back 1% of our SWAN permits because of the possibility of overallocation in the past, but we've moved to a preference system now, which really doesn't have any reason why we hold back this 1% now, so we're going to do away with that language. And we also just need to redefine the definition of youth for our drawings for SWAN and crane application within this rule. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Blair. Questions by the rack? Questions?
I'll throw one out.
Mitch?
Blair, have you noticed, or have you had any inclination that the cranes are affecting our geese hunting, our geese migration, or anything?
We really haven't seen any impact between the two species. Really, the only change, which you're probably referring to, is the increase in the number of cranes that are here later in the year.
So. I'll invite you to come down. We used to have pretty good goose hunting on our place. Geese won't even come in anymore. Because of the cranes. And that's a fact. There's so many, and you can't cracker shell them out of there. You can't dog them out. You can't do anything. But I was just curious at how much effect. You haven't seen any, but I can show you some right now.
Yeah, I know they are consuming more feed out there that would be, you know, otherwise available for Canada geese, but to this point, I'm not aware of any documented problems. They very well
come down and document some.
Okay.
That's a true story. They're so thick in there.
Yeah.
We can't get rid of them. And my goose hunter used to help me throw tires off the pit, and I haven't got any geese for him. So I'll throw them all off myself. But I think it's a fact. What I've seen, they're so heavy in there, the geese have quit it.
Yeah.
Anyway, just a point. I think you get a lot of concern down the Green River and stuff, and I think there's a few people that's going to Scotch here, representative.
Yeah.
You know, we used to have 100, 200, now we got thousands of them. Thousands of them. And they, you know, they're a problem now, and they're going to get worse.
Yeah, and there has been a growing concern about the goose or the crane population here in the basin, and they have been looking at ways to address that. So,
well, I know your hands are tied, but
yeah, I know we've talked about this before, and it is difficult to do much, but we have put some measures forward to try to at least haze those birds more, and we have provided the region with a propane cannon and a few things like that. So, I mean, if you are interested in those options, you could contact the regional office. And
what, how many years does it take to draw us? Swan correctly.
In the basin, it seems like it's usually taken 2 or 3 years.
That's a pretty good deal. So, we've got so many of them, we can't even walk through.
Yeah, so. And I know one of the challenges out here has been for people just finding areas to hunt cranes when they draw a permit. So a lot of the people like along the Wasatch Front will draw them. And so, I mean, you could recommend or at least leave your contact information with the region and they could refer people to you if you're interested in doing that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions by the rack?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Just for my information, how many of the crane tags are, does this area have a specified number of crane tags, or is there just a number for the whole state?
Yeah, so the number changes each year based upon a 3-year count that we do across the whole Pacific Flyway for cranes. And so depending on what the overall population is doing, we get a certain percentage of those permits. And so we distribute those roughly through 4 areas in the state. We hunt cranes here, as well as Cache County, Box Elder County, and Rich County. And so those are really the 4 areas in the state where we're seeing crane problems. So we've tried to distribute those permits based upon the need to address agricultural depredation primarily.
So over the last 5 years, has the number of tags that are let here in the basin, are they more or less?
I'd have to go back and look. It's been about the same, and we've changed them a little bit depending on the year, based upon need. It's been kind of hard to structure those hunts because a lot of our crane populations raised in the northern part of the state, so they're experiencing depredation from really the spring through the summer. And then here, we don't raise a lot of cranes, but we see a lot of them stop here on their way south as they move towards New Mexico. So we've tried to structure our hunts to address both of those needs with permit numbers as well as the season dates.
We do have a number here during the springtime. And they'll eat corn seed. They'll go right down our rows of planted corn and pick the seed out. So I don't know how those numbers are structured, but I would really like to see this area get more tags.
Another question by the rack.
The pintail numbers, what do you attribute that to?
One of the challenges with pintails is they tend to move around quite a bit in their breeding areas. And so where a lot of that area in Saskatchewan and Alberta was dry, it's likely that a lot of those birds probably just moved north out of our survey area. So it could just be a survey-related issue, but we have seen that that population hasn't really responded to habitat conditions like many of the other populations that are 50 to 100% above their long-term average right now. So a variety of issues associated with pintails, but Some could be survey-related, and some could be specific to the population.
Okay, thank you.
Another question by the rack?
Yeah, I have one more question. According to the rule R657-62-22 on the SWAN, number C says division shall issue no more than the number of SWAN permits authorized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service each year. There is not that same rule in the Sandhill Crane language.
Yeah, so for the SWAN permits, that comes specifically from a lawsuit that was done about the mid-2000s where we can only issue 2,000 permits. And so that number doesn't fluctuate at all from year to year. The crane, we actually have a crane management plan that's put together by the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Pacific Flyway to address sandhill cranes. And then that's based upon the three-year average for what we count each year for sandhill cranes. And so that number fluctuates each year based upon as the population goes up or down. So as it goes up, the number of permits that we get increases, and as it goes down, the number decreases, with the intent of keeping that population between about 17,000 and 21,000 cranes.
So is the population just monitored through this Pacific flyway, and not regionally, not local? There's no local input in that?
Yeah. So it's done through the flyway process, and so I serve as a representative for the state of Utah on that committee, and so I tend to try to get as much feedback as I can through the state and try to give our input that is primarily specifically for Utah to meet our needs. But it's a big collaborative process because these cranes occur in pretty much the whole Intermountain West. They're from New Mexico all the way north to Montana. So there's about 8 states that have to work to try to fit all their needs into a management plan. So it gets a little tricky, but we try to structure it to meet as many needs as we can here in the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask one more question?
Go ahead, Mitch.
That brings up the point. So I've heard, and I hear, maybe you're on this committee, I've heard that Wyoming and some of the other states get a lot more permits than we do. Is that true?
Yeah, so the allocation is based upon how much breeding habitat we have in the state and how much wintering habitat we have. So we get about 12% of the total allocation because we don't have a lot of cranes that are breeding here or a lot that are wintering here. So we're essentially considered a staging area state. So we produce some, but the majority of those are produced north of Utah, and the majority of winter south of Utah.
So what I'm seeing maybe happen is you've got a cap on the number of permits, and these other states are getting them all, and we're getting the short end of the stick.
I guess it depends on how you look at it. Because
so if Wyoming gets more, they're going to cut us back.
Yeah, a lot of that is based upon the fact that they have the cranes for a lot longer period of time than we do. So they have the cranes essentially from about April through about September, where the majority of Utah, we only see the cranes starting to move through about October, middle of September, and typically most of them are gone by about the end of November. But, I mean, you do bring up a good point that usually, 10 years ago in this area, most cranes were gone by the first part of December. And they are staying here for longer, and so that's an issue that we will likely discuss when we do our next management plan.
They're not getting hunted. If you want to move some, they need to be hunted.
Yeah.
They chased my dogs.
They just got
so domestic and used to it. They're staying.
And it is definitely a concern for our state, and it's something that we'll continue to try to address through the flyway. And it's really just a relatively recent development within the last 5 years that we've seen more and more staying here later in the year. So,
at least what, Joe? A couple hundred?
There used to be
thousands of them.
4,000 or 5,000 birds. And they're still here.
Yeah.
I'll take you down to my farm, and you put your hand on the ground, I'll bet you'll touch. You can't do it without touching tracks. I mean, it's getting to the point of being serious down there. And we appreciate what you're doing. Get us some more tags over.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Another question, Brother Rack.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, we'll turn questions to the public now. If you would, step up to the mic, state your name. And this is for comments, just for questions.
It's kind of a comment a little bit.
If you're going to make a comment, there's going to be a time for that here in a little bit.
Okay.
It's just for questions on the right now.
On the Sandhill Cranes part and that, as these gentlemen have brought up.
State your name.
John Snow. Okay, the cranes are still here in full number. And I have here an estimate from myself and another farmer of our losses last year and last spring. I will present them to you. and photos on that one. This is my handwritten one of my loss last spring. It seems a little bit high, but when you have to turn around and reload again and go back again and feed again, that's pretty cheap.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Put in the record, he did provide a couple documents here that we'll turn over to division. Thank you. Any other questions by the public? Very good. Don't see any. Well, comments by the public. I don't have any comment cards on this particular subject, but. Yes, I do. I do have one. That's yours, John. Was that the one you had?
That was what I had right there.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. If anybody else wants to make a comment, please fill out one of these cards. Doesn't look like we have. Good. Thank you. Very good. All right. Back discussion.
I'm a little late, Randy. Blair, do the other areas of the state have concerns about depredation, or is that localized out here?
No, it definitely occurs primarily through Cache and Box Elder County. We do have a hunt that also occurs in Rich County to address fairly limited depredation issues, and so over the last couple of years, we've actually pulled most of the permits from Rich County to put in the other three counties. So it does occur in all areas where the cranes are in significant numbers. Tags. Yeah.
Okay. We take their tags, apparently.
I'll definitely let them know.
Blair, what would happen if the RAC here passed some kind of a motion to have the division look into this more in detail because of this issue? It sounds like we do have a pretty good issue here in our basin. Is that something that would help us?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it would depend on what specifically you were asking for. We could look at, addressing it through, probably not really through tags because those are fairly limited, but we could look at how we're allocating tags, or we could look at different measures for depredation. So it's, I guess, your prerogative if you'd like to do something like that. I would mention, though, that the recommendations for Sandhill Crane do go through with our upland game rack cycle, so they're probably not specific to this one, so I don't know if you want to make that a recommendation now or wait for that one to come through. I believe next year or so is when that rack meeting would occur.
Oh, that makes sense. All right, thank you. We need to do it.
Same thought. I know there's a little movement in Jensen, and what I think we need to do is maybe get a few of them landowners and some of the ORA people. Would you be the man to meet with and Boyd?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
Oh, wait a minute.
You're sitting by me.
Yeah,
who asked for
it? Yeah.
That's what we need to do. The guys that are, we need to get together and maybe get a representative, Scott Chu, and have a meeting with these folks. That's a good way to get the process started. And they know we're serious and we got some real problems. So we'll probably put something together and meet with you, sir.
Okay.
True.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Other discussion on this proposal. I think he does. I think he's right. Let's save this this motion that I was talking about for the up and payment. Well, if there is any other discussion, I'll entertain a motion on this particular presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend that we pass the presentation as presented by the division.
That was on the motion made by David Gordon to recommend we approve the waterfowl recommendations and rule amendments 2017 as presented. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Andrea Merrill had that second. Any other discussion? Now, this is a time, keep in mind, I don't know that it's necessary on this, but this is the time if we wanted to amend a motion where there was something in there we really didn't care for, this would be the time to amend one if we did. But I don't think there's anything in this one, but just for ones coming down the road. All those in favor? Eight in favor, unanimous. Thank you, Blair. Appreciate that very much. The next one, topic tonight is topic number six there. It's the 2017 Black Bear Recommendations and Rule Amendments. And I guess you're Rusty?
I'm not.
Oh.
I just was going to explain that. My name's Darren DeBlois. I'm actually the new mammals coordinator for the state. I literally started Monday, and so I'm going to be looking to the back row for some of these questions. What I'm going to do is make our presentation for our recommendations for 2017 black bear seasons, and I will try to answer any questions I can, and I'll call on a lifeline if I need one.
Darren, tell us your last name one more time.
DeBlois, and that's spelled DeBlois, and it's Dutch.
Thank you. I would
have butchered that. My mom is a Tate, and she's grew up in Vernal, so I feel like I've got some roots here. And if you don't like the Tates, I'm sorry. All right. This is the Black Bear recommendations for 2017. And I want to just kind of give a quick overview of the status of black bears in the state as it sits right now. That map on the left shows currently what our black bear habitat is throughout the state, primarily the mountainous regions of the state. We have black bears in most of that country, including over the last 5 years as far north as the Bear River Range in the Cache. We've had bears there in the past, obviously, but we've seen some bears start to recolonize some of that stuff just recently. Looking at our population models, and that's based on our denning data, so when we go and visit dens and look at the cubs that are being born in the dens, as well as some of our harvest-based modeling, we feel like black bear populations are growing about 4% annually right now, although that trend does seem to be slowing a little bit. Black bears tend to kind of have these birth pulses, And so population numbers can fluctuate, but overall it looks like we're trending upwards. These are just some past and some preliminary harvest data for the last 3 years. Success rates are 50% in 2014, 47% in 2015, and so far this year, and we've got most of our returns in, we're about 40%. That'll probably come up a little bit, but that's based on what we see so far. And then you can see the actual numbers of bears that were taken in those years below. This graph shows permit allocation since 1990, as well as harvest. So the red line, obviously, is the number of permits. The yellow line are the number of bears, and as you'd expect, as we issue more permits, we tend to make more bears, take more bears, but we're also making more bears recently too, and so that can reflect population growth a little bit as well. This graph demonstrates our depredation and nuisance mortality. So these are bears They're taken either by wildlife services because they're into livestock, for example. They can be bears taken by the division for the same reasons, or for maybe they're chronic visitors to camps and have gotten too aggressive. They're in watermelon fields, things like that. So this reflects those numbers over the last decade. You see that kind of jumps around. The way we manage black bears in Utah is based on the Black Bear Management Plan that was passed in 2011. And that plan runs through 2013 with intervals of review. So I believe in the Black Bear Plan, it's every 3 years that we review that. So we should be up for another review in next year. We'll be looking at the plan again, just make sure where we are where we want to be and discuss that plan. In the plan, we harvest bears according to three management regimes, and those are those three tables you see there. So depending on the unit, it falls into one of three categories. A light harvest unit, 17% of the units of the state fall into that category. In these units, typically we're trying to grow the numbers of bears. We feel like we don't have a lot of conflicts, we don't have a lot of depredation, we can have some more bears. And so the goal then is to harvest older age class males. We want to have old age class males in the population. And we want to harvest fewer females so that we can get some growth on those populations. The next category is moderate. Most of the units in the state fall into that category. This is maintain or slowing the growth, or maybe even trying to slightly turn the population down a little bit in this strategy, and you can see the brackets, the management objectives in that. And then finally, liberal, 26% of our units fall into that category, and this is where we've got issues with bears. We're trying to control numbers, and we're in harvest mode on those units. Below are the ways, depending on where our harvest data comes in, how we can make adjustments. And so plus or minus 20%, plus or minus 20 to 40%. And if we move from one strategy to another, we can go as high as 50%. And that's all in the plan. If you have questions on that, obviously I'll try and answer those. We have several different hunt types for black bears in Utah. The first is a spring hunt. You can see the dates we're recommending for next year, April 1st through June the 2nd. This is a hounds only, no bait season. That's followed by a summer limited entry season. This is a bait season or spot and stock, and hounds are not allowed. On all of our bait seasons, you can bait up to 2 weeks prior to the hunt starting, in order to establish those bait stations and begin to get bears coming into those stations. We have fall limited entry hunts. Those dates you see vary depending on the units, and the regions have different concerns, and they're trying to address, usually in the fall, they're trying to address hunter interactions with the public and with other hunters, and so that's why you see a little bit of variation there. And obviously the region can answer any questions you might have on that. There's also, you can see in the book cliffs, an archery only opportunity, and no dogs are allowed on that hunt. There is a spot and stock limited entry season on the book cliffs, Little Creek Roadless, and on the LaSalle's and San Juan's. And you can see the dates there. And then we have multi-season opportunities, and this is where you can buy a permit and hunt the various seasons you saw in the slide before this. And finally, we have harvest objective units where, again, we're trying to address bear density problems, problems associated with large bear densities for the most part, and that's where we're setting a quota of bears that we want to see harvested on those units. Now for the regional recommendations. Here's the northeastern region recommendations. The yellow bar, you can see the total number of permits that are being recommended. The blue bar on the far right indicates whether the permits are going up or down or remaining the same. You can see for this region, we're remaining the same across all of those different units. And then the other columns show the number of permits in each of those seasons. So those add up to the numbers in the yellow, if that makes sense. Northern region has two kind of big mega units. We lump those units together, and so we have two, and there we're not recommending any changes in the northern region this year. Central region, they're increasing an increase of 5 permits on the Central Mountains Nevo unit, and they're doing that due to increasing bear densities on that unit. If you look at the individual hunt recommendations permits, the number in parentheses is the number that number increased from last year. So it's not 11 plus 3, it's plus 3 is included in that 11. That's just so you can see how we split those 5 permits between the hunts, if that makes sense. The southeastern region, they've had a lot of wildlife services take over the last couple of years, and so what they're trying to do, they're increasing permits, but it's in an effort to try and shift that take from wildlife services over to sportsmen. So they feel like they want to give more opportunity to sportsmen, and in general, we like to try and go that way when we can. And so you can see the increases that they're recommending there, and that's based on that. The southeastern region also has a unit boundary change. We've made an effort over the last few years to make all of our unit boundaries consistent between species. So a deer boundary is the same as a cougar boundary, is the same as a bear boundary. And this reflects that objective. And so where the red circle is, you can see what they've done. They've trimmed a little bit off of that upper part. And in order to, if you change one unit, you've got to change the neighboring unit, so the LaSalle's would then pick up that chunk that they cut off of the San Juan. The southern region, they're actually, they're over their objective target for females on the beaver, so they're recommending a decrease of permits on that unit. I believe the Ponsagant was the same situation. They're out of phase on the plan recommendations, and so they're adjusting according to the plan. And then they're recommending one more permit on both the Mount Dutton and the Panguitch Lake Zion units. Our general pursuit season dates are as you see there. We also have restricted pursuit seasons on the Book Cliffs, LaSalle's, and the San Juan. And you can see they're restricted in that we only allow so many people to have those permits. You can see resident and non-resident permits available for those pursuit seasons and the season dates. And one thing I forgot to mention, I believe in your packet for the fall limited entry hunt, for the Book Cliffs, it says October 3rd through November 16th. It should be October 2nd. Just so you're voting on the right dates there. That was a typo in the original.
I think mine says October 2nd to November 16th.
It should be, for the limited entry hunt. It's correct for the multi-season is where the error is. So on your multi-season, so if it's the same season, but it's in that table where the error is. And if they've corrected it, I apologize, but I think it was still, last time I looked at the packet, it was still there. So multi-season, Book Cliffs, is it Bitter Creek South? Should be October for multi-season and for fall limit entry, should be October 2nd, should be the opening date. I believe the 3rd is probably a Sunday, isn't it? So, I don't know, I didn't.
It does say October 3rd.
Okay, so that should be October 2nd. I should have mentioned that when we were on the regional recommendations, and I forgot. So just to wrap things up, we're recommending a total of 760 black bear permits statewide for 2017. That's an increase across the state of 48 total permits. You can see how those increases break down between the various seasons. We're recommending those boundary changes on the San Juan and La Salle bear units in order to bring them into, bring those boundaries to be the same as they are for all other species. And that's it.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Darren. Question by the rack.
Do you have the harvest data for the book list?
I do. I'd have to pull it up. And do you guys have it ready? Harvest data for the book cliffs? So they can, I'm sure they can answer. If not, I can grab it. It's got it on my laptop.
We're in the liberal, in the book cliffs. Oh, we're in the middle group, yeah.
I think it's light, the very moderate. The roadless is light. Roadless is light, regular book cliffs is moderate.
Is moderate, okay.
Maybe while Darren's looking it up, double check my numbers, I can maybe shed some light on it.
State your name, if you would, please, Clint.
Yes, sir. Clint Sampson, wildlife biologist for the Book Cliffs area. We can go through the hunt structure, like Darren brought up. So last year in 2016, the spring hound hunt, okay, we give out the most permits for that hunt out of the four hunts we have in the Book Cliffs. And we harvested 15 boars, 15 males, and 2 females during that hunt. And that's an overall 59% success rate for that hunt. So that's the highest percent success rate of the four hunts. And it's also the highest number of permits that we give out on that hunt. Moving on to the summer hunt, we gave out 9 permits, and we harvested 1 boar and 1 sow on that hunt for a total of 2, which equals 22% success rate on that hunt. The early fall archery only hunt, we issued 7 permits for that hunt, and to my knowledge, we didn't kill any bears on that hunt. It was 0% success rate on that hunt, which is kind of surprising for that time of year with bears seeking out food and everything, kind of prepping for hibernation. Moving on, the late fall hunt that we allow hounds, we killed 1 sow and no boars for a success rate of 17% on that unit. And if you add them all up, and I guess to get kind of a total percent success, and Darren might correct me on this one, but I think it's about a quarter, about 25% success across the year.
Yeah. Okay. It's just well, it's thinking.
Okay. Yeah. Mitch?
Can I put Glenn on the spot with a few questions for now?
Please do.
What was that success rate on your bait hunt in June?
The summer one?
The June one, right?
Well,
okay. The June one would be the summer.
Yeah, it was 22%.
And what was the houndsman? They were the highest, right?
In the spring?
Yeah.
Yeah, that first spring hunt was 59% success.
59%. Gail, the concern I've got, the question I got, I'm familiar with the South Slope and Anza Diamond Mountain. You know, you give 13 permits for the pursuit. You don't even give half that many for the bait. My concern is, in April, there's a lot of elevated, you know, higher country that you can't get to. So you actually got less country to hunt. In June, I know when we get a normal year, then you get into your upper mountain country. So the houndsman must have one heck of a lobbyist, I guess, but is there any
Why there's not even half as many given for the bait? Is that because of your success rates? Is that why you do that?
Yes. I want a certain amount of bears taken in the book cliffs. And so we look at the success rate across the board, and you look at who's killing bears, who has the highest success rate. So that's where we put the majority of the.
So these hunts are pretty much all are harvest objective hunts then?
Well, we put these numbers forward with a plan, you know, every time. I mean, every hunt has a certain harvest amount of permits because we have an objective, but they're not like a quota permit, like harvest objective. I don't want to, you know, get confused with.
Well, either one of those guys got good luck in this. Your houndsman, you know, so. I'd like to see a little the ratio just a little bit better myself.
You're not talking about hunting later with hounds, right? You're
just no, bait. You take our country on diamond, and a lot of years you can't get up there anymore. And if they do, they just tear
you
down.
They can't hunt later because of the fawns and the.
The baits. Really
the bait starts June the 2nd. A lot of higher country can be hunted then.
Yeah, without mountains.
Because your snows are leaving and your moisture.
So if I understand you correctly, you want to see a more even distribution.
Yeah, you're not even giving half to the bait hunters. It's just because they haven't got a good lobster.
Well, but they don't have 20% success. So you give them.
So yeah, but that goes off the fact that it's harvest objective. And Clint says it's not all harvest objective.
It's not harvest objective. I think that's maybe
it is if he's going off as a percent of kill. If that's how they're giving the tags out, then it's harvest objective.
Well, we give out a limited amount of tags.
Right.
It's not like a
but
harvest objective.
But you're giving
objective
more to
them go to buy.
You're giving more to the houndsmen because they seem to get a little higher kill rate.
Well, you'd also have to see why
yes.
Was
right.
A low success rate.
So that leans it towards harvest objective type of the way you're giving the tags out.
I think it's more towards a objective of harvest, right? You guys got an objective of amount of bears you'd like to see and a distribution of how you'd like to see them killed.
Yeah.
And that's why you're giving them the way they are.
Yeah. The challenge is overall that, you know, we run in. I'll let Dax
talk.
I'm not making them all for
Clint, you're as big as he is.
I just was going to clarify one thing for Mitch. You know, Clint gave you the data for the book clips, but you're talking a little bit about the Vernal Diamond, and it's a different situation up there. On the Vernal Diamond, the spring hound hunt was 43% success, and the bait hunt was 50% success. So, you know, it varies unit to unit, so don't make assumptions about your unit based on the data from this other unit.
Then we're going back, it's all lobbyists then. Why do they get 13 and we only get them 5? It's not even half.
And you're correct in a way. A lot of these decisions are social decisions. Though we make a biological decision, we have those parameters in our management plans. You know, we don't want to harvest too many females, or on certain units where we're trying to reduce, we want to harvest more females. But then how that, you know, so we decide what's an acceptable level of harvest based on our management plan. And then, you know, whether you get more permits to folks in the June bait hunt or a fall archery hunt or a spring hound hunt, you know, that's a little bit of a social decision, and there's other factors taken into consideration. Now, the success rate's part of that, but you're correct to the point, you know, some of that is a social decision.
Well, and another thing, let's not leave this little dog out. That time of year, that higher country, you can't get into it anymore. You know, when we've had a little drought, it's been a bit of a normal year. Yes, it takes till the 20th of May or the 1st of June.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're going to see across the South Slope, in general, probably higher success in the June hunt because a lot of the Forest Service roads don't even open until Memorial Day weekend. Access is limiting a lot of times for houndsmen in those earlier parts of the year.
And I am talking about South Slope. Yeah.
Excuse me, too. They have the bait hunts and the early hunts when the access is very limited up there to protect sows with cubs. And then they have the bait, and they have the bait hunts also because it gives archers the opportunity to be more selective in what they have up a tree or down on the ground while they're up a tree, or, you know, those kinds of things over bait. So they do try to limit the number of permits at that time of year. in order to protect sows with cubs.
But boy, over a page, you can see what it is. And we take a test before we go barren. So a good, you know, a good bow hunter should know if it's a sow with cubs, because she'll have them.
Most of the times, but they do chase them up a tree when they go out wandering around, especially first year cubs.
So is that kind of the basis why we're not even getting half as many on a bait house?
I would have said yes when I was in charge of the program.
And it all depends on the unit, and what Boyd's saying is correct. You know, earlier in the spring, your boars are going to be the first ones out of the den, the first ones moving, and so that's where you're going to, you know, we're more likely to take boars on bears that are harvested earlier in the year, and that's another big reason of why we gear the tags more towards the spring, because we can harvest more boars from the population without having an impact on the population. You don't need as many boars. Boars don't have babies. So you know, there is some science that goes into the strategies and allocation. A percentage of it also is preference and what hunters want. And you're correct, you know, a selective hunter could choose to take a boar, but the data shows that the hunters tend to be a little less selective on some of these other hunts where they feel like their opportunity to take a bear maybe is less, so they're less picky because they just want to get a bear. It just depends.
Thanks, Doug. Other questions by the rack?
Yeah. Chairman, I've got a couple of questions.
Dan Almeida, he's the one we said was on his way.
Yeah, Darren, thanks for your presentation.
Sure.
The 4% growth, that was statewide, right? You mentioned that earlier in your presentation.
Right.
And then you had a slide following that 4% growth slide. It looked like, I guess I'm trying to figure out, is that over like the last 5 years, 10 years, or is that over the course of, you know, I'm just trying to get a kind of a temporal scale.
That's a good question. And I'm not sure I know specifically the answer. I know that it's based on our denning activities. We've been doing that now for probably about 8 years.
Oh, okay.
So I think that's probably a good frame of reference, and that's something I'm going to have to look up. But it's primarily based on that. And again, it's across the state because some of those units have very small sample sizes, and so you kind of have to pool your data to get an overall. So it could vary depending on the unit year to year.
And then I think the other question I had was the management plan. Looks like about a 12-year management plan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
2011 yes. to 2023.
Right.
You probably mentioned this, and I just missed it. But is it reviewed every 3 years?
I believe it is every 3 years, and okay. I need to. The cougar plan and the bear plan, I think, are slightly different. But what I can tell you is it is up for review next year.
Oh.
So next year we'll be looking at that and just evaluating our targets and seeing how things look based on what we're doing right now.
I see. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Darren, the Utah Hazmat Association, you probably seen their proposal letter, what
right.
they'd like to see. What do you think about that as far as the moving the date of the Booklift one in line with the LaSalle date?
Well, I think, and you may not be aware, that the southeastern region last night actually changed those dates. The reason that the dates are the way they are is this is a people management strategy. You have the Booklifts where you've got a very narrow summer range, and so you're going to have a lot of people on the mountain in a relatively small area all at once. The region would like to try to avoid putting hound hunters on top of limited entry hunters who burnt bonus points, and some, you know, some of those guys is probably even a once in a lifetime hunt for elk, and so that's the strategy. That's why that date is different up here than it is down there. And if you guys want to add, Clint, yeah, go ahead.
I just want to understand. I think I understand their proposal, but what the complications are with the impacts with their proposal.
Clint Sampson, again, wildlife biologist in the Booklifts. I got a string tied to me. This time. I get out of hand, they'll pull me back. Just to add a little bit more about what
please.
Darren commented on about that. In the past, we have had several complaints from archery, limited entry, big game hunters, and also other rifle and muzzleloader big game hunters that are hunting deer and elk out there in the Book Cliffs. And the complaints mainly are that, you know, they were sitting in water holes, sitting in certain drainage, and, you know, here came a pack of hounds and, you know, blew a lot of the animals out of the area where they were hunting. And I don't know if many of you have ever hunted with a bow, but in the Book Cliffs, for big game, especially for elk, if you hunt hard, you probably have a chance, maybe one or two chances of getting a chance at a trophy bull elk in the Book Cliffs, and that's if you hunt hard. And if one of those chances was taken away by houndsmen coming through an area, it just creates a conflict. And so we tried to take that conflict and create a new opportunity. And that new opportunity came in the form of an archery-only bear hunt in the Book Cliffs during that early season. And so we created a new hunt, new opportunity to kind of spread the wealth around. Look, Mitch isn't even paying attention to it. And so tried to spread the wealth a little bit out there, spread the tags out, and then also give the houndsmen a good solid block of time to hunt bears later in the year where those limited entry conflicts would not occur. And so we took that as an opportunity, as a challenge to make things better in the Book Cliffs, and tried to listen to our public that way. And so that's why that reflects the season dates.
What do they do to San Juan?
Yes, sir.
What was the question, Larry?
The question was, what do they do in San Juan? And as far as for that conflict, and they just allow it. That was the answer, right? They just allow it down there.
Yes.
Okay.
And they do have where we've moved that date to October 2nd. That allows them to hunt before the spike hunters start as well. They get pretty much almost a whole week to hunt there too before they start getting other hunters on top of them that way.
I think in the southeast too, they tried to move that hunt outside of the limited entry hunt down there, but they had them go earlier. And through the rack process, there's a little bit of adjustment there. So there actually is a no hound portion of that. So you can probably see that in the dates in your packet. That's how they tackle it.
Okay, thank you. Another question, Brother Wright.
I have one. You said that the Southeastern changed the dates, what was it, yesterday night?
Right.
What dates did they put it to?
It's the same as those the San Juan down there. So, look at that.
They changed the set.
August 19th.
Yeah.
I believe. Yeah, August 19th through September 25th, and then again the 28th through the 16th. And this, I don't know if this is relevant to this meeting, but so far they're the only rack that's made that recommendation. Everybody else is kept it the same.
Darren, one other question. The Houndsman Association also had a. They wanted to move the pursuit tags, the same numbers. I think was it. They wanted the LaSalle the same one, same as the San Juan. What impact would that have if we did something like that?
The reason the tag distribution is the way it is down there is they're conducting an experiment on those units. They had concerns that. With a high density of bears and a high amount of pursuit, they're actually pushing bears down into the lower valleys. They had a lot of bears coming into town, and so what they're doing is they're adjusting the pressure of pursuit on those two units to try and see if they can detect a difference in bear movements. And then what they're going to do next year is actually flip that. So they'll switch the distribution then. To put it heavy, I'm trying to remember which one is which.
Yeah, LaSalle's the light one.
One is five.
San Juan's the heavy one.
Yeah, so they'll reverse that, and they want to see if they can detect the change. So that's why they're recommending it to be that way, and they'd like to continue that experiment. I support them in that. I think it'd be interesting if we can. That's a big question that circulates, and it'd be nice to get an answer to that.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Other questions by the rack?
I have one more for Clint. The summer pursuit season, what impact does that really have on the Bears? Do you think it's significant?
As far as an impact on that cup, Clint Sampson.
What was your title again?
I've heard that the Dogs are hard on the Cubs in pursuit, and you have a loss just because of the pursuit.
Like the Cubs getting stretched, getting killed by the by the Dogs before they can make the safety. You know, that question might be geared maybe a little bit more towards our law enforcement that might deal with those conflicts a little bit more on the front line. Or maybe even some of the houndsmen might, when they have comments, might want to maybe address that too when they get a chance. When they get a chance and use their 3 minutes. But
there's no way to know, I guess, is there?
No.
There's
not a way to measure it. But hopefully the houndsmen take the opportunity to look at the tracks before they dump their dogs and go after them in the summer, especially those early months when the Cubs are still
pretty sensitive. Training. I mean, that's a dog training season, right?
Yeah, we call it the puppy dog training season. And so hopefully, you know, the houndsmen are aware enough to, take some incentive before they start a pursuit to look over the tracks and see if there are any small Cub tracks, and if there are, you know, hopefully they abstain.
I guess we can ask the houndsmen, but that's contrary to, I mean, they're valuable dogs. They probably don't want to turn loose on bears, big bears, I would assume.
Well, there's some amount of pride that comes along with being a houndsman as well, and being able to say that, you know, you treat the biggest bear, you know, on the ridge and things like that too. So,
I just wanted your feel on that.
Yeah,
that's amazing. That's okay.
Hopefully, I didn't muddy the water too much for you.
Okay. Thank you, Clint. Any other questions by the rack? Well, if not, we'll have questions by the public. If you have a question, please step up. If you have a comment, wait just a little bit. We'll give a comment. J.C.
J.C. Brewer. And I'm not a houndsman, so if I ask a dumb question, don't let Clint slap me. Let's go back to that graph you had on there a minute ago about the number of permits being sold and the number of bears being taken. I don't understand that. We're increasing 4% a year on our bears. We've increased the number of tags being sold above 700, but yet our harvest is going down. That's a widening gap, a disparity there. I don't understand. Would you or Clint or Dax or somebody explain that to me?
Right, yeah.
What's causing that?
Having not dived deep into the numbers, what I can say is a lot of times as you increase activity in the field, a lot of time you can see a decrease in success rates, and so this has a lot to do with that. Also, you know, that last year, again, you know, this is preliminary data. I'm not sure how that little downturn is going to change, but I think your observation is correct. You know, as we increase permits, there seems to be an increasing or a decrease in success rates over time. Randall, did you want to add anything to that? Go right ahead.
I think part of the question, this is Randall Thacker, part of one of your questions, are you talking just the one last year, this last year's dip, or the widening gap?
I'm talking about the trend there.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were asking. Let me try to explain why it's getting wider and wider. That's exactly what I wanted to try to explain to you. Several years ago, we went through, when we set this new plan, part of the intention of the plan was to try to increase opportunity for bear hunters and create new kinds of opportunities. And so we have created the harvest objective units and some of these things. We've created a lot more spot and stock hunts, which are lower success rate hunts. We've created a number of different varieties of these archery hunts, like you referred to, some of these different types of hunts to create opportunities for more and more people to come in and get involved in bear hunting, because when they're involved in bear hunting, then they're more interested in the species and they care about them. And so we wanted to involve more and more people. And so actually, we have introduced several new hunt strategies that are less effective. The success rate goes down a little bit. And that was intentional. So yes, that's exactly what you're saying. That's
makes sense.
Now the 1 year dip this year, do keep in mind this data is not all finished. Not all of the late season bear data was included, harvest data was included. This was all had to be put together before the hunt ended. So there is some harvest that's there. By next year that may come back up and be more level looking than a dip this year. But we'll wait and see on that. But that was the original idea.
Thank you, Randall.
That's great.
Yep, come on up. State your name again, if you would.
My name's Ken Long. I'm a houndsman, have been for years. And my main concern is the same concern I brought up last year, the year before. And it's the decline in the black bear population in Book Cliffs. It's steadily going down. And I read in the paper where
Is this a question or a comment?
This is a comment and a question.
Okay.
I'm not through yet.
All right.
But on these numbers, are you counting all the bears, what's killed in the watermelon patches and depredation hunts is a total, or are they separate from just your
in this
kill
graph?
Tags?
Yeah, so does this graph show all that depredation? No, this is just harvest, so sport harvest. This other graph, this shows this would be an addition to that graph as far as bears that are taken in depredation situations.
Was that jumped in 2014 and 2015? Did the Green River watermelons have anything to do with that?
I don't know specifically, but most of that increase was in the northeastern and southeastern region, so I think that's probably a fair assessment. But if the region knows, then please speak to that. But if you look at the regions, that's kind of where
I speak to your question just for a moment.
Sure.
Some of that was, I know looking at the data, it was 2014 is the big spike here. 2015, as you notice, it was back down to about a normal trend. That we did have a bad cycle for problem bears, and it was not all just in Green River. Green River did have an increase that year, too. It was definitely not just the watermelon patches that were the problem. It was across the regions we were having problem bears. Across the entire state, really, that year. The Wasatch Mountains, for example, I thought there was an increase in depredation on livestock all the way across the entire region and across the state that year. So it wasn't just the watermelon patches, but they definitely did increase that year, too. It was an increase that year down there.
Another question is on the livestock depredation. Last year was a bad year for some of them down the Book Cliffs. Them cows about starved to death. How many is being turned in for as bear kills?
Let me see. I've got numbers for last year. Wildlife Services takes. We can take a look at that. Let's see.
A bear is a scavenger. If they find a dead cow with winter kill, they will clean it up.
So on the screen. This is for 2016. You can see those are all the units in the state. You can see that column that says depredation and other mortality. And then to the right it says WLS control. Those are bears that were taken by Wildlife Services according to our records. So that's for 2016. If you want to look at other years, we can certainly do that.
Just add to that, looks like 2015 we had two taken, and 2014 there were four. The year before, the 2013, there were two bears taken. So this year, as of yet, they hadn't taken any. Last year was down. Is that 2014 was kind of that year we talked, that spike that we talked about? That would be those two additional animals.
My recollection, too, in 2014, it seemed like it increased, but it wasn't just one specific unit. It seemed like it increased across, you know, the eastern part of the state, but it wasn't just, you know, that specific area. Like Randall said, it was kind of something happened that year that increased that take.
Well, I spent a lot of time out there, and I'm telling you, your bear population is down. Very low.
On the Book Cliffs?
Yes. When you can go out there and spend 2 months bear hunting with hounds, and you can only come across two bears, there's something wrong.
Right.
No cubs.
Does anybody in the region want to speak to that at all?
You got another question, JC?
Well, I've got a comment part here, but
But let me just add this. We do have collared bears on the book cliffs. Brad Crompton in the southeastern region has got some. I asked him what his cub data was looking like, and he felt like he had good production, but he wanted to keep an eye on things. And I think that's one of the reasons why the region's not recommending any increases. We are within the plan parameters, and so obviously if we start seeing something there, we'll make adjustments as necessary. Also, bear in mind that the plan is based on a three-year average, so we're looking at the last 3 years when we're making recommendations for a given year. That's just informational, Dax.
No, I'd like to say, you know, I appreciate Mr. Long's perspective. I know he's a long-time, you know, guy that spends more time in the book list than about anybody. That being said, you know, I know our habitat guys got a lot of trail cameras up, and we are seeing some cubs. You know, we've got bears, salvage cubs using our guzzlers. And, you know, in our harvest data, you look at our harvest data, we had 1 year where our percent females jumped a little bit. And we decided, you know, even though with a three-year average, we still had leeway to move permits, we decided to leave it alone, keep an eye on it, see what was happening. This year, again, our percent female in the harvest has dropped. Our percent males that are 5 years old or older, you know, remains high.
47.
They're 47%. You know, I'm not disagreeing with Mr. Long, but so far we haven't seen anything in our data that would indicate that we've had some kind of, you know, big decline in our bear population in the book cliffs. If you plugged it into a model, you know, and you look at long-term data sets like Dr. Hal Black of BYU's collected and the data that the division continues to collect, there's nothing there that would indicate to us that we're having some kind of, you know, precipitous decline in the bear population there. And our recommendations, again, we're trying to be relatively conservative with our recommendations, even though we have the leeway to increase permits based on the parameters of the management plan. We're just leaving things the way they are, because we do appreciate the input we get from our sportsmen, but at the same time, we're trying to stay in compliance with the management plan. And there's a lot of other considerations out there as well. You know, the book cliffs is one of our units where our deer population is struggling, and there's not a lot of direct predation on black bears on deer, but there's some evidence that suggests you may have black bears that are taking lion kills from lions, which forces the lions to kill more. There was a study done on the Colorado side of the book cliffs showing that. I'm not saying black bears are a giant contributing factor to our deer population there, but when we're trying to manage a deer population that's at 50% of the objective, you know, we got to look at every possible option and every possible tool. So, you know, sometimes one species affects another species, and there's a lot of things taken into consideration there. I hope that maybe answers a little bit of the question, and maybe it's not what everyone wants to hear, but that's where we're coming from on it.
Thanks, Dad.
One more question. I know we're not recommending, or the recommendation isn't to increase permits this year, but what did we do for the year before? Did we raise the tags in? Or
no, we left them the same.
So this is the same as a couple of years ago?
Yeah, well, the same as last year.
Same as last year, and do we know what the year before was? The
year before, I think we had a slight increase.
Increased because that's when we made some of those changes and added the other kind of hunts.
Added those hunts.
So total, again, increasing opportunities, that stuff, there was an increase back the year before.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Dex. Thanks, Randall. I think we're going to jump into comments now. I would like to...
Thank you, my question.
You got another question?
Yeah.
Or not a question. Yeah, get up here.
Yeah, I've got
a question. Stand up the mic and ask your question.
Jesse McKee, I've got a question on your depredation program. Did they get kind of a thing where you, if you're a landowner, they give you a depredation tag, but it has to be a family member or the owner that kills the bear? Is that correct? Wasn't that introduced last year?
Yeah, it's
I remember
similar.
Talking about it. I don't know if it ever went through.
And if I understand what you're talking about, we had a program for cougars where a landowner that was suffering depredation could get a permit. I believe we did extend that to bears as well. And so the way that works is they need to identify the caught. You know, it has to be a bear that took livestock. That mm-hmm. Wildlife Services can verify that, so they'll bring that paperwork in. It doesn't have to be a family member. They can issue the we'll issue the tag once they can show us that they've got problems to anybody that they designate.
Okay.
And then those tags will be limited to a certain area. So usually, you know, if it's an allotment or private property, that's up to the region to decide how they want to
how they want to draw the boundary around those things.
Darren, if I remember right, they can't sell that tag though, right? They've got a.
They can't sell the tag, and they can't keep the animal. The animal has to be turned back in to us.
Just out of curiosity, why not sell that tag?
That's just the rules. I mean, that was in the rules.
Is that the rules we make?
No. That was in the rule of the where they allowed that to even happen.
Okay. The intent there is to handle the problem, and so it's not. There are other opportunities, I think, with bear tags for a landowner to charge a trespass fee, those kinds of things. But this is specifically to address a specific problem, so that's why they can't sell it.
Clint or Bax, did we give you guys any numbers on bear kill on cattle last year? We're probably not very good at that in book clips, are we? I know I had a few. I never turned in.
How many kills the bears?
You know, if we had a kill, we thought if I had a cow or a calf, I thought was killed by a bear, I didn't do the best job of letting you guys document it.
You need to notify the Wildlife Services. They investigate every kill to document it to see if it actually was, if there's any evidence that it was killed by a bear, and they keep track of that for every landowner to get that information if you had a big report.
Okay.
That's what we hear. We hear the number of bears killed.
Okay. All right.
But we don't hear the cows.
Because I definitely need to do a better job at that, because I wasn't aware that was that we had to have that.
Danny will pass the information back to us. He has to fill out a complete form, and sign it, and verify it, and then we get that information, and then it goes into our stuff. Plus, there's also damage payments for loss of livestock from black bear and cougar.
Okay. So we definitely need to do a better job on that. And is that a pretty good? Does that work fairly well? Coming out, you know, if I say it's killed by a bear and it's a cougar or whatever, are they able to identify what done that fairly easily? What's the time frame you got to catch them on?
Well, you got to get them before they get too slippery, but the kill I'm talking about. But they can get out there and they do a really pretty good job of identifying whether it's coyotes, whether it's bears, whether it's cougar, because they all have their own habits in what they do with the kill. And so they can get out there and they can look at it and they can figure it out usually.
All right, well, that's good.
Unless it's really, really old and sloppy.
Well, that's what I was asking. You know, sometimes days old and however old you come upon it and make your assumption may not be correct or may be correct. So thank you.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that question. Other questions before we jump to comments? All right, I've got one of our RAC members isn't here tonight, Daniel Davis. He sent all the RAC members his input on this particular topic. I'd like to go ahead and read that so that his voice gets heard, even though he's not here tonight. But Daniel says, regrettably, I will not be able to attend the upcoming meeting. However, I'd like to share some of my concerns and issues that I feel need to be looked at and considered. The biggest issue that I have, and those that are concerns of those people that I represent, is the bear proposal being presented by the division. I feel we are leaving science out of the equation for proper management of the predators in the book cliffs. I have a desire to hunt all species of big game in the book cliffs, and have done so for many years and feel I can make a credible comment in that regard. The approach that is being taken in regards to predators, cougars and bears in the book cliffs, has turned into a social overrule on desires rather than science. There's been over 80 cougars harvested in 3.5 years, and 2 years of liberal harvest on bears, which resulted in almost 50% harvest of females in the first year due to lack of feed, preventing the females to gestate and give birth little to no offspring. In doing so, the female bears successful to harvest with no cubs with them to prevent harvest, which led to nearly 50% harvest last year. The reason that the female harvest was lower this year was due to the females having the feed last year to ensure their health, to have a successful gestation and higher offspring rate, and giving or having them by their side prevented hunter harvest of the females. In years that have good forage and feed, which will maintain enough health and to produce offspring through hybridation, therefore will never allow for the harvest objective of females to be taken, thus skewing the numbers to drive the increased permit sales, which lead to a potential of illegal harvest of those females just to be successful. Just from the female harvest in 2015, there's been a huge decrease in bear numbers across not only this unit but the entire state. He writes, the impact this is perceived of these large predators on the deer herd is just a perception. The reason I say this, it's over the last 15 years, the deer herd in the Book Cliffs has maintained 53% of the herd population objectives. He writes, therefore, I do not support the increase in permit numbers, especially in the Book Cliffs. Then he has another issue here that has to do with the spot and stock, which had to do with the LaSalle time frame, which we already talked about, so I won't get into that. But I did want to make sure that Daniel's voice got heard tonight. Yes. So other comments, I've got two comments cards. Anybody else has comments? Rich, if you want to make a comment, there's comments cards out there. I need a comment card. First off, we'll have Ken. Do you have?
I already talked.
You already said yours. Okay. JC, do you still have a comment?
I do. JC Brewer, and I'm not a bear hunter. I'm a deer and elk hunter. And so I'm the guy that's been pressing the folks in front of me here to control our predators out there until we get our deer herd up to objective. I got two things I want to say. One of them is that I want to challenge this theory that I'm hearing that the bear numbers are down in the Book Cliffs. That's not what I see. I run cameras out there year-round. The only person out there that's got more cameras than I do is Ben Williams. And he's got a lot of them. I've got three cameras out there I'll leave all winter. I'm having no problem finding dozens and dozens and dozens of bears. My bear pictures are actually increasing, and I got quite a few bears with sows with cubs this year. One of them, two of them with three cubs. The other thing that I wanted to comment on and want to make was on the dates that houndsmen are not allowed to compete in the area in the Book Cliffs with the people drawing permits for deer and elk. They hunt their cougars all winter and bears all summer. They could give us a break in the fall, 6 weeks or a couple of months, where they're not out there competing with us, not only for the problem with the hounds making noise, but with the additional dust, the additional noise, and the additional crowding on our roads. I support the division's decision to put an end to that for a while, keep them, the houndsmen, from hunting during the big game hunts. Thank you.
Thank you, JC.
Can I make one rebuttal against that, please?
We've got a comment card for you. You haven't been up here yet. Please do. Come on up, Mike.
I filled it up.
Huh?
I filled one out.
I know you did. That's what I say. We've got a comment card. You're legal. Come on up.
I can understand how somebody feels if they draw a lifetime permit out there for an elk. Do you know how many points it takes to draw a bear tag now out there? I've never done it yet. And I've hunted it a long time. And he's saying it's the houndsman's causing problems during their hunt. There's people out there every day running around on four-wheelers, setting trail cams everywhere, early in the mornings, late in the evenings. That affects the bear hunt, too. They run over the tracks. You can't see a decent track. You know, it's not just the houndsman causing problem, it's the other hunters too. A bunch.
Yeah, I understand that, Ken, thank you. I think the concern was during the archery hunt. Well, no, not during the archery hunt. Help me if I'm wrong, but we started during the limited entry elk hunt, we added a spike elk hunt in there, and now we've also got bear hunters out there with hounds kind of the same time, so we've got kind of three hunts going on out there. Thank you. Jesse McKee, we got another card for Jesse, come on.
Jesse McKee, I don't even know where all your guys' cameras are, because you're going to catch me doing stuff. I've seen on the computer you was really close to one of my spots. I didn't know you guys on the underpasses. So if you get some of them, you don't blackmail me.
You'd be surprised what they're seeing.
on this bear stuff, And I'm probably lean more towards anti-bear and, you know, the deer and stuff, but with everybody being out there and that, kick them all out if you guys could is what I prefer, but if you can't, I'm seeing, you know, I think the bear numbers are healthy, and I don't think our deer are going to improve. You know, you've got one problem or the other, and I'm not picking on one side or the other, but you're, I think the more bear we kill, the better deer we're going to have, and the more cows we're going to have, so of course I'm going to go to that side, but I'm thinking the bear numbers, I haven't noticed a decline in them. So I would have to go, like your information you read from off that email somebody sent you in there.
Daniel Davis.
Yeah, I would disagree with that information, and I think I spend enough time out there to kind of have an idea. And you know, when we see it on what we come upon riding around elk deer, whatever, that's been killed, and when there's less and more of them, and I'm seeing a few less this last little while, so there's that. But, yeah, I'm not picking on one side or the other. I mean, houndsmen are your big game, but I think if you could increase your bear numbers out there, I'm for it. That's from the ranching side of that.
All right, thank you, Jesse. Any other comments on this one? Any other comments? Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, let's open for discussion. Now, if you would speak into a mic, Ed.
I just had one comment. The science, the whatever the comment was about not using science. Every question, these are tough decisions, but every question we've asked, they throw up the number. And so I think the science is there. There's a lot of social issues to try to decide how you decide it. But I guess I totally disagree that there's no science behind it.
Thank you, Brett. Okay, we'll close the comment period on the public and start on our discussion. How are we feeling? Mitch.
I'm pouting. I'm going to vote against it. No, seriously. I'm not going to support this action. I don't think it's time to make an amendment on it that I would support if it was made. I think the thing to do is get the landowners we need and the livestock people and get with Dax and Samson through the year and work on what I discussed earlier tonight. So that's the reason I'll probably have no vote on it.
We're talking the Black Bear recommendations.
Right.
And
because of the South Slope Diamond Mountain tag distribution.
Okay. I understand. Other discussion? I mean, it is, you have the opportunity to amend it if you want to.
I don't feel this is the right time for it. It shouldn't pass anyway. I think the thing to do is deal with Dax and Clint, you know, through the year for the next fall and work out our issues and do it. Anyway, and that's my opinion.
So, Mr. Hacking, if I may, how are you going to handle next year's hunt if we don't do anything for a year?
Well, I can make an amendment, but I don't think I'd be going anywhere with it. I'll make an amendment then. I'd like to make an amendment.
Wait.
I would like to. Well, I guess we better have a discussion period first.
Yeah, let's have a discussion, and then if you want to amend the proposal. Let's make the proposal first, and then you amend it if you'd like to, because I think that'd be the way to do it.
Just an observation on that.
Yeah, listen.
So the numbers for this year, there are no change from last year. So in a sense, there is no change happening for our area. If he wants to get together with Dax and figure out what they need to do, vote approving this move is not going to really do anything else.
Yeah, unless he wants to make an amendment to raise the tags on the booklet or the Diamond Mountain area, he could do that. Which we basically tell the wildlife board that this if the RAC approved it, that we all feel we have an issue out here that needs to be addressed and just need to pay attention to.
You were just talking about changing the ratio.
Yeah, I kind of need to understand maybe what he's proposing.
Yeah, I haven't proposed anything yet.
Yeah, but just as far as what the discussion is, I don't think it's the numbers, it's the allocation from spring to summer, is it not? For Diamond, more so than upping permits.
All this has to do with South Slope Diamond Bonanza, and it's mainly, and there's other areas, but that country's too high for an April hunt on a normal year, and June comes, and then our bear come out, and I feel that we are, I think we need a couple more tags.
You don't think there is enough bears being harvested because of the allocations?
Not for our area on Diamond Mountain. And any higher area, as far as I'm, you know, a lot of your higher areas you can't get into. Yeah, and I'm just making the comment that that's the reason why I won't support it. But I really feel, and I will make amendment, but it'll take a year to get the process done, I would think. Joe made a good point, so.
Yeah, now would be the time to do it, if at least get it out on the table if we want to. But let's start with a motion first, and if we want to make a motion to approve this, and before we vote on it, we would entertain any amendments to that motion.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, then, in the interest of time, I'll move that we accept the proposed recommendations and move forward with that and allow Mr. Hacking to have an opportunity to make amendments to that motion.
All right, so the motion was to approve the 2017 Black Bear recommendations and rule amendments as presented by the division. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Second by David Gordon. Now, if we want to make an amendment to that, we would make it at this time.
I would like to make an amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And it strictly has to do with just the South Slope Diamond Mountain vernal units, the spring hunt and the summer hunt. I would like to make a proposal that two more permits come off the spring hunt and go into the summer hunt.
Two permits come off the spring hunt onto the summer hunt.
So that the higher elevations, when them bear come out, it would be a little more equitable. And I'd also make the comment that it was brought out that there is a good success rate on this particular area on that. And I'd also like to point, Boyd had a good point, but I mean, if these people are taking that test and learning what the bear are, which you're supposed to do, I think that the sows and the cubs would probably be all right. And then there's also the aspect, if we're getting more bear up there because they're not getting hunted because they're coming out later, we're going to have more depredation problems. So we'll be taking the bear through depredation permits. This way, at least the sportsmen are getting a chance to get hunted.
Okay.
So my amendment is that we take two tags off the spring hunt on the South Slope Diamond Mountain vernal unit and put them on the summer hunt.
Rory, did you get that?
Two off the spring and
onto
the summer.
On the South Slope Diamond Mountain.
I'm not getting greedy.
Oh, okay, no, you're doing very good. Okay, we've got a motion out here. Do I have a second of his amendment?
I will second his amendment. Makes sense.
We have a motion and a second by Andrew Merrill. All those in favor of this amending the original motion with this amendment, please show by raise of hands.
Could we ask questions to the wildlife biologist, just maybe Dax or Clint on that to see what their thoughts are on moving those around as far as the success ratio? Because I think we heard what they were in the book cliffs, but I don't know if we completely understood what they were on Diamond.
Well, we've only had the June hunt for 2 years now. That's a relatively new hunt for us. The first year we had that hunt on the South Slope Diamond Mountain, it was 100% success. Last year was 50% success. The spring hound hunt last year was 43% success. And what was the year before that, Randall?
It was 31%.
31% success. So on the South Slope Diamond Mountain, that June hunt, the summer hunt, seems to have quite a bit higher success rate. So if we move a couple tags from the spring hunt into the summer hunt, we might end up harvesting, you know, an extra bear than we would have if those permits were in the spring hunt, which could have an impact down the road if, you know, there's probably a little leeway in there, but it could have an impact if we, and that's part of, you know, when you look at the tag allocation, you look at historic success rates, and
and you know, where we're at with regard to our age and our percent females in the harvest. So it might result in an extra bear being taken, but it might result in an extra bear being taken in a place that a spring hunter wouldn't be likely to take a bear. So, you know, those are just some of the things to take into consideration. I don't know that two tags is going to, you know, collapse the bear population on the unit, but over time it might have an effect.
To just add to you, Dax, I'm talking about, people probably think that I'm just talking about Diamond Mountain and the Diamond Mountain. This includes the forest. This includes
the
South Slope Diamond. Yeah, this includes
from
a lot of that.
From White Rocks over.
Yeah. This ain't just Diamond Mountain. This is,
sorry. I just associate you with Diamond, Mitch. But
this is all that country.
You're correct. Yeah, Vernal Diamond Bonanza.
This opens all that, which a lot of that country in the spring and April isn't open.
That's true.
Mitch, do you have a fair amount of depredation? Is that the reason that you are proposing this amendment, is that you feel like there's some bears that are taking your livestock?
It's tough. That is a tough thing to find. It is really tough, but we've got a lot of bear out there.
Okay.
I'll guarantee you that.
Okay.
A lot of bear on Diamond. And maybe needing a few courage calves. Anyway, so.
Okay.
But it's not just Diamond, like
right,
I say.
Right.
It's the forest and all that other country, and you just can't get up there in April.
Yeah.
Unless you want to tear the world up.
Okay.
I just want to see a little more equity in the amount of tags. Because
there's more success in the summer in this particular area.
That's what it sounds like.
Okay.
Right. Thanks, Joe, for bringing us back to center there. Other discussion? Well, then we'll call for we've got a motion and a second on the amendment to the original proposal. Let's vote on that amendment. All those in favor? A show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's unanimous. So our motion and the amendment passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Can I make a motion? We take a 5-minute break.
We have a second? Yes, let's do it. Thank you. Okay, it's quarter till. Let's reveal. Let's take 10 minutes and reveal. Start again at 5 minutes to 9.
Because, you know, that makes, you know, it made sense when you thought about it. You know,
to evaluate during the inspection of COR?
Yeah, that would be part of the inspection process. So, you know, there certainly are some waters that look like they have no connection, you know, during, say, August when there's very little water flowing through them. But we will be, you know, definitely looking at the potential down the road during a high water event for some connection being made to. And again, that's just part of the COR inspection.
Okay.
Before you leave, I have a question. A natural stream flow is what we're talking about.
Stream channel.
So what is what defines that? According to the DNR, the Division of Natural Resources, define the natural stream, natural stream channel. Got to flow water one time in 10 years.
Once again, Drew Cushing, section chief for the aquatic section. Right now we're working on a definition with the representative of the Utah legislature because the definition of a stream channel, we don't want it to negatively impact private aquaculture, but we do want to protect native species. There's also, you know, the stream access issue, which is kind of in the courts right now. And so we have to weigh that in this definition as well. If you're too liberal, I don't want to drag this out too much, but if the definition of a stream channel is too liberal and stream access passes, potentially a fisherman can access private ponds through the stream channel. They can access Robert Judd's fish hatchery to go fishing perhaps. And so we just want to make sure that we get that definition right. And we are working on that. You should see a definition to that in this legislative session upcoming.
Doesn't the access rule right now mean that they have to be wet?
Right now, statewide, it's up in the air. They were settled a couple of years ago, but they've thrown it out in Utah, except for two, on the Weaver and on the Provo Rivers.
Isn't that the most access rule that you're talking about?
It is, but the definition of what a stream is, if that goes statewide, which is very possible, is going to have an impact on everybody's private land, private ponds, streams and springs that flow through private property as well.
So in my mind, a natural streaming channel is pretty clear, but what about a diversion off of what I a natural stream channel, a diversion off of that? And so you're going over a, you know, I don't know, 100 meters, 200 meters. So your private pond, and then
those are considered legal. Right now, those are considered.
So that's not considered a natural stream channel.
No, it's not. And those, if you have the right species, you know, that are allowed there, you can stock those without a COR as long as there's a screen to keep that escapement, you know, from this going on in public waters.
Thank you, Drew.
You're welcome.
Do you feel like that there needs to be the definition before this proposal or can go through? Is that something that you feel like can go through without that definition if they're still working on it in the legislature?
I don't think. This rule affords the opportunity for those stockings to take place regardless of the definition of a natural stream channel. What we ask now is the same thing we would ask after the definition comes down from the legislature, is a threat assessment of what that stocking has to natural or native species either down below or up above.
No, you can ask a question. Go for it, Richie. State your name, though.
Richie Anderson. I just had a question as why it takes 45 days for a COR. If you have three criteria, it seems like that could be done in a matter of a few days. It's not like doing a NEPA or an EIA. I'm just wondering why we're looking at 45 days to do a COR.
I don't know if it generally does take 45 days. We're putting a 45-day limit in our rule, but, you know, Drew or Trina could address it better than me, but from our perspective, inspecting as fish biologists, it doesn't take us 45 days. There's some lag time on the front end for processing paperwork and stuff like that before it even gets to our hands for that inspection, and that's something that we're working on internally within the divisions to streamline that process right now and make that happen faster.
Trina, what is your time frame now on an average COR?
Hi, Trina Hedrick. I'm the regional aquatics manager in the region. So if I get a phone call from someone who wants fish in a pond, I prioritize that. I really do. That's one of the most important things that we do. So I will make every effort to get out and inspect the pond. If I need to do an inspection, oftentimes I don't. I just find out what their situation is just by phone, sometimes via email. Sending pictures sometimes does the trick. But if I do need to get out, I will get out, and within the week, we work through it. I'll help the individual fill it out, let him know what he needs to do, get it sent in, and then, so my time span tends to be less than 2 weeks, but there's more going on. So when that COR request application gets sent in, it goes to the back of the line. And that person in licensing, I guess is where that individual is, basically pulls from the front. And so it's just a matter of when that request came in and how many are in front of it. And he's permitting tournaments. And there's a lot more of those these days. He's permitting COR applications, research applications. So it's not just private pond. They're all together. They're not separated. So that actually is the backlog because there are so many requests for various things that he has to work through. That's my understanding.
And now you're going to increase that by 10 times.
So it's more than just this regional office. It's going to go to a state office, and it takes some time in that office.
It does, and it's just one person doing the work, and really it does sound like he's got a lot of COR applications, and he's making progress. You know, when he started, that position had been open for 4 months. There's no one doing that, so he's making great progress and getting that backlog going, but it just takes time. There's so many requests.
Okay, thank you, Trina. So, Randy, help me understand, what was this 45-day thing again? Was that 45 days that You'll do it in 45 days, or it actually takes about 45 days?
No, we just say in our rule, within 45 days, we'll grant the COR.
Within 45 days,
yeah.
So the applicant...
So it could happen in 4 days. You know,
it could happen in 4 days, or 45 days is the max.
Well, no, 45 days is the max. I'm just saying it doesn't necessarily take 45
right.
days. It could take substantially less time. It depends, again, on schedule for people inspecting the pond, the backlog they have in licensing, that kind of thing.
So could you move us back one slide? Help me understand, why is this new rule going to create more CORs? So let's see, on here, you still have the same thing, not located on a natural stream channel, the same three criteria. On this one, you kind of had a middle, is species sterility not permitted, request certificate of registration, industry can stock after COR granted. And then it had a third, stocking not permitted if pond is on natural stream channel. Okay, I'll see.
Yeah.
So again, let's go to the next one. I don't see why. Okay,
so,
again, at least not one of the above met. Isn't that the same as in the past one?
No, there's a subtle difference. So
okay, what's the
difference? The difference is if you follow the very right-hand arrow, we're saying right now, under no circumstances.
So he's saying now the way it is, under no circumstances can stocking be permitted if the pond is on a natural stream channel or
yes.
lacks screens. So with this rule, he's giving them the opportunity to request a COR.
Yes.
If their pond is on a natural stream. So I don't understand your concern.
Well,
because the way the rule is now, if the pond is on a natural stream, they get nothing. With the change, if the pond is on a natural stream, they could stock it if they go through the COR process. So
the problem comes down to the definition of natural stream channel. So
it does now.
I know, and it's the same issue. We've
okay.
been trying to get them to change that.
So
and
now
so
they're trying to change it to
all
make
they've
it
done is
better.
Allowed. No, all they've done is allowed you to stock in a stream through a COR. They
through,
haven't
through
changed
a
the
review process.
Right.
Through a planning and review process.
Right. But they
which
haven't
with
changed.
The idea behind a planning and review process is that they're looking at it on a case by case basis. So there, it is going to take time, but won't that help the landowner be aware of the problems that can be associated with fish escaping from a pond and the possibility of causing problems upstream or downstream to the native fishes? So isn't this an improvement?
In some aspects it is, but when it comes down
to... And then
to
if the legislation makes the ruling on the natural stream, won't that enhance this?
No, because
change?
This will be in rule.
It will be in rule, but it will provide clarity, and this at least gives them the opportunity to have their pond studied for stocking. So
what it's going to do is it's going to delay people from getting fish. We have a narrow window when we can deliver fish. You only
I
have 3 or 4 months.
Understand
and,
that.
And
but
that's going
as
to
an industry, it. Could you do some education and outreach to your buyers about the need to be planning this stocking in the winter?
We actually are planning right now, if this rule passes, that everybody has to have a COR. That's what we're going to tell
well,
them.
Well, and what so. About an education process? As an industry, you know, you're aware of your current customers, and get the word out to people that a COR could be needed. I mean, isn't that a way to handle it too, rather than just asking for a total exemption?
We're not asking for an exemption. We're saying that most of the ponds that we stock is a small spring that wells up next to somebody's cabin and then goes
yeah.
into a pond area. Well,
but there's a channel that leaves it.
Everywhere water is a channel. So
right.
technically
possible,
under this rule,
I can't
have a fish farm technically under this rule.
Well, with possible impacts to other native species.
Can I ask a question that may be relevant or not? So we have a lot of other states around us that are trout, you know, as well, Wyoming, Colorado. What are their definitions for growers? I mean, do they have similar definitions as what we do? Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho that are, of course, trout fisheries as well.
Yeah, really every state in the West presents the industry the same set of criteria that we're presenting. The one difference is we're a little bit more relaxed where we're presenting these three criteria and providing an opportunity where there is a possibility for no COR and no, you know, inspection from the division. Really every other state in the West requires in all circumstances an inspection by their wildlife management agency.
Can I address that?
No, you can't. I'm sorry. This is the discussion period. All right. Other discussion.
The example that was brought up of a pond that originates in a spring, if the water did not leave the pond, they would not need a core.
Yeah, that would be probably an example where they wouldn't need one.
They would not need one. Only if the water was leaving and there was a risk to
if
downstream.
Yeah, if the water is originating directly into the pond and it doesn't leave that pond, that would be an example of, you know,
not needing one.
Yeah.
So doesn't leave means never leaves.
Yeah, so all the water basically evaporates out of the pond and there's no outlet, which there are waters that are that way.
What about the very first brought up, the school institutional thing? Do they just need a COR on that as far as adding that, getting rid of that if it's necessary?
Well, okay, first off, when we talk institutional aquaculture, it's actually more than schools. This involves prisons. We also have situations like universities for research studies, that kind of thing, hold fish. So it's a little bit more broad than schools. But more or less, actually, the Department of Agriculture rule mandates that the Division of Wildlife has to grant a certificate of registration for nonprofits.
So it just has to go through
COR. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's really for us just documenting where we have those situations in the state.
Okay.
Comment on that? My mom and dad are both teachers, and they're both fairly responsible. Like, a COR would probably be a wise choice, so they go and release this fish that they don't release it. There was a situation down in Etham. I don't know if it was a school project, but there was a lot of guppies in the natural hospital. So I don't know if you're familiar with that. I think it got taken care of a long time ago. There's a lot of pet fish in there. So.
Guppies.
Yes.
Good one. Yeah. It could get in.
Other discussion.
Cart.
Yeah.
So we got a couple different things out there. Do we want to do something with the schools, the educational, institutional type stuff? Do we want to modify it to what Mr. Judd has recommended, to where water originates on private property? We don't have to worry about it. So. If we do, I guess we could do a motion to accept the presentation, and we could do an amendment just like we did on the last one. So be thinking about that. I'll entertain a motion right now to I'll just entertain a motion.
I'll make the motion that we accept the action on private pond amendments made by the DWR. That we accept them as presented. I'll make that motion.
That was Mitch Hacking made that motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Joe Arnold made a second. Now would be the time if we want to entertain an amendment to that, to make that amendment.
Could I ask another real quick question?
Please.
Mr. Judd, how have the other RAC boards responded to this? Have you had any luck?
We're going to ask Randy.
Okay, Randy.
Yeah, it's been through four RACs. Three of them accepted the division recommendations. And then the fourth one went with Judd's recommendations.
Which one was the fourth one? Which?
The Southern.
The Southern RAC. Thank you.
Did you go to all four RACs?
I I've been to four of the five.
Four of the five. You're persistent.
There's only three of us in the whole state. We're pretty small.
All right, we've got a motion and a second. Do we hear any other discussion? Do we entertain any other amendments? I'm not hearing any, so I'll call for a vote. All those in favor of the private pond rule amendments as presented by the division, please show by raise of hand. Those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 in favor, 0 opposed. All right, thank you, Randy. All right, we've got some IAIS rule amendments. Mr. Judd, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Appreciate your input. Yep.
I understand. And I don't think you're Nathan. You Nathan?
No, I'm not. Sorry.
Okay.
Nathan's right there. I'll be giving the rule change here, the rule changes with the AIS program.
And you are?
Richard Gibbs.
Richard Gibbs. Well, that's what I wrote the right name down there. Thank you.
I think I have the right one, so if I don't, let me know.
Okay.
Again, I'm Richard Gibbs. I'm with the region here. I'm the AIS biologist. And so we have four proposed rule changes in rule R657-60. And the reason for these rule changes is because of our two lakes that we have, Lake Powell being infested and Deer Creek being suspect. And infested, just give you a little background there, back in 2013, Nate, was at Lake Powell. Lake Powell became, when we found our first adult mussel there, during our Belger sample, we found some Belgers. And then soon thereafter, we started finding the adult mussels. And from there, it just exponentially grew the adult population, which is infested, meaning a breeding population. And at that point, there's nothing you really can do for the reservoir. It's just containment. And then Deer Creek is different, quite a bit different, suspect. And what that means is we just found three or four Belgers when we did some sampling back in end of 2014. And since then, our sampling has come back negative. And so right now, we're hoping if everything plays out right within the next year, that will be delisted from suspect to is it inconclusive, Nate? Or is that undetected? So that's our hopes there. So anyhow, that leads us into the rule changes that we're proposing. Well, one more thing to say here. Since then, Lake Powell, well, the reason why we're wanting these proposed rule changes is currently from the first 2 years we were just seeing the worried about the water being transported from these boats from Lake Powell. Within this last year, we had 50 mussel encrusted boats that we had to worry about, and that imposes a whole other issue than just worrying about the waters being transported from Lake Powell. First rule change is mandatory dry times in addition to professional decontamination for boats found to have mussel attached. So right now we have the mandatory dry times, and that's dependent on the season. But what we found out once we started getting these boats from Lake Powell that had mussel attached to them, we needed to, for them, after they're decontaminated, to wait the prescribed dry times. And the reason for that is with these boats that have been in Lake Powell for a period of time, they have mussels everywhere. And no matter how many times we decontaminate this boat, we're not going to get it 100% clean. And so in order to get it completely clean, we need them to wait the prescribed dry times to be 100% sure they're not going to be passing these on to another reservoir.
What is the prescribed, the mandatory dry time?
Sure, yeah. So right now it's 30 days in the wintertime or 3 days of freezing. And then come spring and fall, it's 18 days dry time. And that's once everything is drained off your boat. So if the boat is still wet at all, that those dry times don't start. And then the summertime, it's 7 days. Rule change number two, that is all conveyances or equipment leaving an infested water body must be drained prior to departure, and drain plugs and other devices that retain water must be removed from watercraft during transport. So the first part, we're already doing this. Like at Lake Powell, we're making sure that our technicians are making sure everything is drained coming off the boats coming off the lake, or if someone's not there, the owner needs to make sure that they're draining their boat before they can start having the dry times so they can go on to another water body. What we're proposing now is what they're doing in other states is when they're traveling, they need to have that plug out of their boat. And that just facilitates making sure everything is drained so that dry time, which what is the thing that does kill the mussels, can start at that point. Now, what we found out when the technicians pulled the plug or had the owner pull the plug and drain the boat, and then the owner put it back in to transport it and arrived at one of our highway check stations, when they pulled that plug again, there was still water in the bilge. And so this will help alleviate any water that is still in the bilge once we initially is drained at the ramp. Rule change number three, remove Colorado from the list of affected water bodies within the region. Colorado has had a few lakes, the most recent one being Pueblo, and where they did find the biologists when they did their sampling. But like a few of our lakes, like Red Fleet being here, they just found the biologists, but nothing happened, no reproduction. And so after 3 years, 3 to 5 years, they're able to take to delist that water body because there's nothing happening in that lake. And so, just like our lakes, we're wanting to remove Colorado from our affected water body list.
Does Colorado have any right now?
No. The very last one was Pueblo, and that has been delisted or is in the process. Rule change number four, the inclusion of quarantine language under Rule R657-60-11, conveyances or equipment detainment, allowing UWR conservation officers to restrict watercraft from launching without taking possession from the boat owner. And so law enforcement can right now can detain a boat, or let me get the right word in here. They can impound a boat right now, if needs be. Like if we get a boat from Lake Powell that has EIS laws that they're breaking, if we find a mussel on it, they can impound that and then make sure it waits the proper dry times and everything checks out. The problem we're finding now, getting all these boats from Lake Powell that has mussels on them, is we need to change that wording a little bit or add something additional to just impound. We need to add quarantine. And the difference in verbiage there is once we decontaminate a boat, and that, going back to our first rule change, and that owner needs to wait the prescribed dry times, we don't want to have to impound that boat. We want them to be able to take their boat back to their house and let it wait the dry times there. And so this rule is already in place. The law enforcement already has the authority to do all this, but it's just a slight change or addition in verbiage there so the owner can take their boat and do the dry times.
And you put this little tag on there with the idea that they can't take it off themselves. They've got to have next time they go launch a boat, they've got to stop at a state place and have them check it, make sure they waited the right
That's
way.
What we
ask. Is that what that picture
is? What it is, those are our seals that we use, and each state has a different color of seal. We use blue and orange. Blue means it was fully decontaminated by us, by one of our personnel. And the orange means if we weren't able, or we didn't decontaminate, but we did an inspection process to make sure everything was drained, like Deer Creek. We do that a lot in Deer Creek. And so that's a difference there. And as far as the owner being able to take it off, we, under the circumstances of a bulb that's been encrusted by mussels, we would like for them to, once they've been decontaminated somewhere else, and then once they arrive to the destination water body, we would like them again to contact us, and we'll do a final inspection, then we'd remove the tag. But as long as they wait the dry times, they're able to remove the tag themselves at the ramp.
How do you track that?
You know what, that it is difficult to track. We do have a program that does track it, though, in as best we can real time, where we are able to see where this boat was decontaminated. The technician puts it into the tablet, and then once that's uploaded, we're able, when we pull up that bout number, we're able to see what was done performed. So it's basically like a balance check to make sure what these individuals are saying is correct. So that's all I have. Any questions?
Questions by the rack?
Yeah, Richard, what is meant by other devices? That's, I think, what's up the second change. There's the plug, removing the plug, and...
Okay.
So what was meant
sure, by that? that's anything that contain water that can be drained. So that could be, you could have live wells, ballast tanks usually have their own system, it's not so much of a plug, but anything that has a plug on it, that draws up raw water from the lake needs to be removed when they're transporting it. So as soon as they leave the lake, once it's pulled, they have to leave it out. And a lot, like I said, a lot of other states are doing this or moving towards it. So
another question too, on Lake Powell, did it go straight to infested, or were there villagers detected prior to the being infested?
I'll let Nate talk on that.
Nathan Owens, I'm the AIS coordinator for the Division of Wildlife. So that's a good question. The National Park Service did detect villagers at Lake Powell prior to the infestation classification. But generally that's the way it works, is there's first a detection, then it's verified, and then the Wildlife Board actually makes that designation. So it's hard to tell what that date actually was. There's a little bit of confusion there, but they did detect them back in 2012, and then it was subsequently verified. And then in 2013, they started seeing the adult mussels, and that's when the infested classification was made. So
like Deer Creek is currently suspect, right?
Correct.
The villagers were detected 20...
just over 2 years ago now.
Like 14, something like that?
Yeah.
So it has to test negative for how many years before that suspect?
For a suspect water body, that has to test negative for 3 straight years.
3 straight years.
And so that will occur January of next year. So just over a year from now.
Okay. Thank you.
There's been several incidences where they've detected the villagers, like Red Fleet, and then we did get the full-blown mussel explosion. What happened? Why did that not take place?
That's another good question. There are a few different possibilities that could have occurred there. The first is, when we detect villagers, we cannot tell whether those are alive or dead. So you could easily have villagers introduced into a water body that are already dead. And so they show up in a water sample under a microscope, but there's actually nothing living in that reservoir. So it kind of raises the red flag, but there's not really a threat there. There have also been a few issues with cross-contamination of other samples in some of the labs that we've used in the past. So that's also another issue. The other issue is maybe the villagers were there, and maybe they were alive when they were introduced. The problem with villagers is they're very fragile, especially when they're super young, less than a week old. As they start growing and accumulating calcium from the water column, they settle out as adults. In order to successfully reproduce as adults, they have to settle out on the substrate within 12 to 18 inches of each other. So they may have settled out as adults, but they were so far apart that they couldn't successfully reproduce, and so that population just ended up dying out. So that's pretty common in several reservoirs around the West.
Another question by the rack. Comments? I'm not going to ask for questions by the public. I think they escaped.
Any of you guys ask questions?
Comments? Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make the motion to win. Move to accept this as presented.
Okay.
I'll second it.
Joe Batty made the motion that we accept the aquatic invasive species presentation as it was presented, and it was seconded by David Gordon. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please show by raise of hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Unanimous. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate that. And our last one up is dedicated hunter rule amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Drew.
Drive careful.
Sorry, Brian. Hey, drive safe. We're going to record it. You can play it when you get back to your office, Drew. Lots of love for you. Yeah, what did I do? I haven't worn my good suit.
Lost our public.
We got to put you first next time.
Yeah. Let's do this. How about we do this? All right. My name is Brian Christensen. I am the state coordinator for our volunteer services and the Dedicated Hunter program. I got an easy one for you. This is kind of a fun one. So. Dedicated Hunter rule change, for those that may be not as familiar with this program, basically it's a general deer hunting program where we allow participants that draw a place in the program the opportunity to hunt three seasons for three consecutive years, and they do that in exchange for 32 service hours of Division of Wildlife approved service, and a maximum harvest of 2 deer within those 3 years. Right now we have over almost 8,000 participants in this program, and they contributed just in 2016 alone about 62,000 service hours on various wildlife projects. So our main purposes for this are basically to update some wording so that we have consistency within other statutes and the rule itself. While we were at it, we thought time to clarify a few things, simplify the rule a little bit more, and also address some common requests that we had from participants within the program. So this is another way of us listening and coming back with some ideas and opportunities for hunters at their request. So clarification part, basically the big one was just to change the license requirement language. The way it was set up is that by statute you have to have a hunting or combination license every time you are issued or apply for a big game permit. But this Dedicated Hunter program is a COR, it's a certificate of registration, and so it kind of fell into a gray area. We've clarified that. Basically we made it the same thing as any big game permit that you would draw. So the first year when you apply to be in the program, you have to have the hunter combination license as you apply. And then whenever we get around to printing your permit, we're not going to look again. We figure you had a license to begin with. You'll be good for the first year. Second and third year, we will look to see if they actually have a license before we issue their deer permits. So it just makes it consistent with all of their big game stuff. The appropriate use of hunting tackle. We didn't think we needed to say this, but it turns out it's good that we clarified that during archery season, a dedicated hunter needs to use archery equipment. And muzzleloader, the same thing. And the any weapon season, of course, has its own set of tackle and firearm that is appropriate. So we've just made that more clear so that there's not that gray area question of what they should use. The wildlife conservation and ethics course is the same thing. We just always assumed that once you joined the program was the appropriate time to take that course. And we just wanted to put that in rule to say, yes, that is indeed when we intend dedicated hunters to participate in that training. Simplification, we have had for many years, non-residents have had the option of purchasing all 32 service hours if they chose. Residents have only been allowed to purchase up to 24 of those service hours. The intent was to get them out on at least one major service project in the field. What we found is that by rule, the current rule, there's an opportunity for dedicated hunters residents to purchase supplies for our projects, things that the division requests specifically. And those dedicated hunters that want to purchase their 24 hours and the additional 8 end up doing it through those means. So essentially we're already offering them the opportunity to purchase all 32, it's just in a different format. We thought, why not make it just the same for everybody? If they want to purchase all 32, go ahead. If not, we'll love to see you on projects instead. At least this evens the playing field between residents and non-residents. We wanted to also consolidate some language, so we took a whole bunch of provisions about suspensions that were throughout a couple of different sections. We put them all towards the end and made it in one spot. We've also done a couple other things. These next two topics, probably the bigger two. The current rule allows us to credit military participants of the program that are also military if they are activated, mobilized, deployed during their three-year time frame. Because the intent was, if they're not here on a deployment, they can't be doing service hours. So we would basically waive or credit them a particular number of hours per month that they were gone. And what we've really found is that there are so many different types of deployments, activations, and situations that it didn't really serve them, and it was kind of hard for us to make these judgments of whether they qualified or not based on the current rule. So what we've just come up with is something simple. We've consulted with some military personnel. They felt like this was a good resolution, and that's that if they are in the three-year program and they get deployed or mobilized for a minimum of 3 consecutive months, that we just offer them the opportunity to say, add 1 year to my 3 years, I won't hunt this year, I'll talk to you when I get back. So that's the opportunity, is to extend 1 year. This would also work for those that perhaps they did their service hours, they were ready to go hunting, and sometime, you know, second week of August, they get a letter in the mail that says they gotta go. They get deployed during the hunts. That may not be a 3-month period, but it takes them out of the hunts when they were ready for it. And we would offer them the same opportunity of 1 year extension. They would retain the same requirements, the same number of hours, the same as everybody else, but they have another year to take care of it in the future. The other part for extensions would apply to two different types of folks. And one is occasionally we have folks that help us out with poaching incidents and reporting those situations, and they become a recipient or a potential recipient of a reward permit. If that's a limited entry deer permit, this happens very rarely, but they could call us and say, hey, I have this opportunity to go hunt a limited entry deer this year. I'm in the dedicated hunter program. They wouldn't have to eat that year as a dedicated hunter, and we would offer them just to push their dedicated hunter program 1 year further out. That would also work for a limited entry deer permit. Somebody that draws that permit from the big game drawing as well. There's about a handful each year that also call us and find out that the current rule says that if they take that permit, they've just eaten a year of their program, but yes, they still have to do the service hours. So these two categories, we would like to offer them the opportunity to extend 1 year and not lose that whole 3 year time frame that they've put that time and effort into. The signature requirements are a simple one. We just wanted more flexibility with our CORs in case we ever go to electronic dedicated hunter CORs to be able to electronically sign those. Right now that it requires a paper signature. So that's just a flexibility thing. Removing the service hour exemption for participants relocated for educational or religious purposes. That's a mouthful there, but basically what it is the current rule says that if you are in the program and you need to leave the state for a minimum period of 1 year while you're in the program, then we will waive your hours for that year, but you don't get to hunt the year. It eats up the year and you just call us when you get back. We found that fits very, very few individuals. They're gone 9 months, or they're gone 6 months, or they're gone, you know, the tail end of the hunts on the third year. It just really isn't working very well. Despite its intent to relieve some folks as they, you know, go on these educational, you know, out to a different college or on a religious endeavor, they're not going to be in state. They can't do their service hours, and this was kind of a hope to alleviate that situation. What we've decided, though, is maybe it's just better altogether to remove that accommodation and just make it easier for folks to withdraw from the program altogether. What that does for us is it helps us with folks that have job changes. They get relocated and move out of state. Or life situations. We have a lot of folks that call with divorces, family situations, injuries, illnesses, you name it. They are in the program, and they need a better way to just withdraw and start over some other day, you know, some other year, when things aren't so crazy. So the current rule here, up on the screen, you'll see two sides. Right now, you can withdraw, or what we call surrender, if you have zero permits issued during the 3 years, and any number of hours. You don't have to have any hours, you can just get out. We require a formal written signature to withdraw, and that's it. If you had one permit issued, you'd need 10 hours minimum before we let you out of the program. And then there are provisions for injury, illness, and death. Those were not changing, so I've just put it on both sides because it's the same for as it was now and in our recommendation. The new recommendation is if somebody has no permits issued during their 3 years and no hours, they can withdraw at any time with no consequences, and we wouldn't require them to do any service hours if they don't have any permits issued. If they get one permit, then we moved it up to 11 hours. We just felt like that was closer to the one-third of the total service hours. And then if they've had two permits, they would need 22 hours complete, which isn't really too big of a deal because if they had two permits issued, they would already be at a 16-hour level anyway. So they would just need to complete a little bit more and then they could withdraw. The hitch, though, with two permits issued is if they have harvested both deer, they don't get to get out. They're in the program for the long haul. It's part of the commitment. It's two deer in 3 years. So that's the one change there. I have a little note at the bottom here. It says that service hours in excess of the minimum are not extended. And what that means is that let's say I have 28 hours done, and I have one permit issued to me, and I decide to withdraw. Well, I only needed 11, so I had a whole bunch of extra. The question was, will we move those extra hours into a future COR down the road? The answer is no. We don't forward any hours into the future CORs. This is good for what it is. If you have extra, we just say thanks, and this is your way out. So, those opportunities and these changes we feel are going to accommodate a lot of requests that we've had from dedicated hunters and also make it a whole lot simpler to administer the program. And it should be a good thing for everybody, so thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Got one question as that come up. What does it cost to, you know, if they want to buy hours instead of do the hours, how much is that per hour?
We've set that. It's been years and years, but the value is $20 per hour. That's what it's rated.
And is there only so many dedicated hunters allowed?
Yes, technically. The way it's written in rule is it can be up to 15% of each unit's quota. So right now we have under 8,000. If we have 86,000 permits, 87,000 deer tags, it's 15% of that number is what it could be. And my math isn't that fast, but what's that, about 13,000 people?
Do we hit that number?
No. The most we've ever had was 10,000, and that was back when we were doing regions. We are increasing. Last year we were about 700 fewer than we are now. So it's going up, but we haven't reached 8,000 yet for a while.
Mitch?
Two questions. How many dedicated hunters we got in the Northeast region? Do you have any idea? Are we average,
I think there's three.
Low average, above average?
No, there are fewer of any of the regions. This is the lowest quantity by residents, but not necessarily by hunting here and by projects here. So by,
in other words,
by where they
people
live,
from somewhere else will come here and do a project.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And do they get the tags for this year? Oh, sorry. No, go ahead.
That was my set. What's the prerequisite for projects? Do you guys set them up? What type of projects do you do?
Well, just about everything wildlife related. So we, sorry, I was just looking for that number. I thought I had it right here, but I don't know if I do. No. I've got it broken down by hours, but not by... This is something else. Okay, sorry.
How many?
I don't have that number with me.
I think you're 17 or something.
No. Did I text it to you earlier?
There's a little over 200.
Is there more than 17?
Yeah, there's like
200.
Okay.
Oh, okay. 500?
That's quite
a few years ago, I can tell you it was less than 50.
Wow. Of course, I'm surprised. I'm surprised.
But you look at population bases like Salt Lake, Provo, and Ogden, and just based on the quantity of people who live in those cities, you're going to have a higher number in those regions.
Are these younger people?
It's all over the board.
Across the board? Mm-hmm.
The lowest number of folks in the program as far as age is the youth. We're 250, I think, is the number I saw. For those under 18 in the program. But you asked two questions, and I don't think I answered either one of them yet.
I was walking on you a little bit. You didn't have the answer. You got to be fast.
So the regional number, I don't know that right off, but I can get it to you.
It went from 17 to 200. So.
Well, that's... You're increasing in the region.
The reason I was asking about the projects is, just for an example, I know of a couple places where there's an old fence. It's next to a new fence, and it's causing a little trouble with the deer, especially the younger deer. Do you ever, would cleaning an old fence out like that be considered a project?
Yeah, so let me answer your first question then, or your second. I don't know if it's the first or second. Maybe it was both of them. What kind of projects do we do? Essentially, whenever somebody suggests a project to us, or whenever we're lining up projects with the regional habitat or biologists or other folks, we ask a couple of questions, and one of them is, what is this going to do for wildlife? Now, that's number one. What is it going to do for wildlife habitat? And then what is it going to do for public access to the resources? And then beyond that, sometimes we look at other questions like, does this enhance wildlife recreation or stewardship opportunities? Or related items. So we partner up with the BLM to do projects with them. We partner with Forest Service. We partner with cities and a variety of organizations to do wildlife-oriented projects. And it can be anything. It could be from removal of invasive species, weeds, things like that, fence removals. We put up and rebuild so many fences a year. It's pretty wild. how many we do, especially when we see double fence lines where you have one fence and then 2 feet later you see another fence. We like to have dedicated hunters remove that second fence line so that the deer don't hop into the fence and get caught. We did a project with Mule Deer Foundation last year like that, and they took out at least a mile worth of fencing and immediately saw a difference in how many fence were getting, deer were getting hung up on that fence. So you name it, we've probably done it as far as dedicated hunter service goes. The things we generally don't approve are things that don't benefit wildlife. We do a lot of things, even on some private lands where we see that there's benefit to public wildlife. We even consider projects there too.
So if a guy's got something, he sees a problem, and I guess I'm going to have to come in and talk to you.
Yep, then he or she needs to just contact one of us, like Tanya here. Call Tanya up and say, hey, Tanya, I have an idea for a project, and she'll ask you a bunch of questions.
Bring a little cash.
Unless you're funding your own project, cash isn't going to get you anywhere.
She's really tough.
She's tough. Yeah, we actually encourage folks to think of projects. The WRI website was mentioned, I thought, earlier today. We love that because it's already projects that are listed. We like hearing from sportsmen and folks that are out there.
You get them tearing out them old fences, though, you might go from 17 to 2.
That may be why you were so low for a while. You probably took too many fences out of here. I don't know.
Thank you.
Okay.
Other questions?
Here's a question. The example you used for somebody to take this on a military activation, they get activated in the middle of August, right before hunting season. But they've already done their 30 whatever hours. If they get that 1 year extension, Do those hours go with that extension?
Yeah. Anytime we do an extension, it's just like having a fourth year, okay. But no additional requirements. Everything stays with it.
So those hours do go with that extension?
Yeah. We just
so
basically...
They return and they can...
Huh? They pick up where they left off. Yeah. We recognize that they won't be within, you know, here for a year.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So are they guaranteed tags through the dedicated hunter program if they put in, and is it region specific?
Now, is that, are you asking me the odds of getting into the program, or
yeah? Well, if you said like there's only 200 in this area, I don't know how many there are supposed to be in this area. Do people try to come and put in for the northeastern region from the south because there's not as many dedicated hunters in this area? Do you see something like that where you get more dedicated hunters and then they have to hunt up here? They get the tag for the northeastern region because this is where they... Is that how it works?
It's very similar to how all other general season hunting works. Is they folks have hunted the same place for years and years and years. They apply for where they want to hunt, and if they draw it, they hunt there. I don't see that being the dedicated hunter program as far as percentages being really anything different than what the general rifle hunt would be like. There are guaranteed opportunities in the sense that whatever the quota is, let's say there's 100 deer tags on a particular unit, that means we can have 15 dedicated hunters there in that unit. And if there's 2 that joined last year and 3 the year before, then we have 10 new spots to open up. That's how that works each year. We just kind of rotate out. As far as availability, last year I think we filled up about 10 units of the 29. So dedicated hunter has, in many units, a lot better odds of drawing than any other type of permit. So it's a good way to get into deer hunting.
So it is region specific. When you do apply for a dedicated hunter, you're applying
it's
for a region?
More so than region, it's unit specific.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just even unit.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
If I understand it right, when they go to draw, the first ones that get drawn are the youth tags. And then the second is the dedicated hunters. And then it's everybody. Is that?
You're real close. Yeah, it's lifetime license holders are first, then dedicated hunters,
and then
youth. Because dedicated hunters are tied to that 15% quota for the unit, and if you do youth first, it complicates that 15%.
Okay.
So then after dedicated hunter, it goes to youth.
The odds are a lot better if you're a dedicated hunter.
Yeah, in most cases, yeah. Yeah, and well, in 2/3 of the units, it's you apply for it and you're in. Did I just say that out loud? Yeah, in 2/3 of the units, if you apply for it, you've drawn it. But 1/3 of them, it's you might have to wait a year or two to get in.
Other questions?
No. I know. Can I not ask a question?
I don't know the rules here.
If you come sit one of these chairs right over here.
Oh, my gosh. All right. I can't get out of my bubble.
All right, Tanya, go ahead.
All right, Tanya Kiefer, Outreach Manager for the Northeast Region. Brian, can you please explain or tell me when this is going to apply? Is it going to apply to dedicated hunters that are in their second year now, third year now, second year next year, third year next year, or does it start completely just with the dedicated hunters that start in 2017?
That's the first time anybody's asked me that.
Hello, I'm cool.
But guess what? I got an answer for you.
I'm awesome.
So how this will work, if these recommendations are passed, which will be through the Wildlife Board, first week of January, then there's a public comment period. I believe it's 45 days before any rule can become activated. So late February is when potentially this could go into effect. And then as soon as it goes into effect, then we can start applying this to anybody that wants to withdraw or take advantage of these other opportunities. The good news is we're not really changing any structure of the program. It's just the ability to leave the program if you need to. And so it won't help anybody that's really trying to withdraw before they're going to apply for this next season. It'll be close. There might be a week or so after it goes active, that it might help a few folks, but far and away, the majority of the folks that are in this, that it will benefit most by this rule, will be those that find out that they've drawn in May, June, or those that are finding out they've drawn in May, June and realize that they really didn't want the unit they drew, or something has happened, and they're just ready to take a break before they get going on this. So. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank
Outreach
you.
Manager Tanya Kiefer?
Yeah, yes, thank you very much.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Entertain a motion on this particular item?
Let's get Tanya to make the motion.
A motion that we accept changes as presented by the division.
David Gordon made a motion that will accept the dedicated hunter rule amendments as presented. Do I have a second?
Second that.
Brett Prevedell had a second. All those in favor by show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Unanimous. Good job, Brian.
Thank you.
Worn down.
Told you it was a fun one.
We didn't see too many bad dedicated hunters here.
Yeah. Okay. They love it.
Guys, I'd like to take just a second and wish you all a very Merry Christmas and thank you for your service and everything that you do. I really appreciate it. The state really appreciates it, and so does the wildlife. So thank you very, very much.
Does that mean you get a Christmas present?
Mr. Chairman?
There should be a card in the mail.
I know we're late, and we'd like to adjourn. But if I may please, and it's up to the board, could we send a directive to the Wildlife Board to better understand the distribution of the sandhill crane tags and how that works, and let them know that here in this region we feel like we are not getting an appropriate number of tags?
I think we can, but the upland bird one we're going to do in, is it May is when that discussion
And we would like them to know about that when they get that in May. And so if we start the process now, I think they would have a better understanding.
Okay. How would you want to word that? Make a motion that help me understand that.
I make a motion that we send a directive to the Board of the Wildlife Board to better understand the distribution of the sandhill crane tags, and that we in the Northeast region feel that we are not receiving an appropriate number of tags.
Did you get that okay, Rory?
Almost. Okay.
Would you read that back? Read us what you got.
He wants to send a directive to the Wildlife Board to better understand the distribution of the sandhill crane tag and the Northeastern region is not getting the... typo, sorry. The Northeastern region... is not getting the appropriate amount of tax.
How about receiving instead of getting?
Or that we need more.
Okay. Wait.
That we need more, not less.
Yeah.
Receiving. Okay. Did I almost get it?
That's really good.
I will listen to the recording.
Very good.
And more, not less, right?
Yeah, way more.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, we got a motion on the table. Do we have a second? Hold Mitch's hand down.
Wait a minute. Oh. Okay, a question quick. Do we need to add on there why we're doing it? Because of what's going on?
I think
so. The increased numbers is so great now, and the depredation is increasing so bad. Do we need to add that or not?
Yeah. I don't know if it needs to be in a motion, but it does need to be explained to them at the time.
Yeah.
I do. I have to actually... explain all the motions and everything we do, and I will make sure that...
Do you want me to type it?
Please do. Explain why we're doing it, because we're we feel the depredation is too harsh here for the amount of birds we have is too much.
Let me ask you.
And they're chasing our dogs off.
Should I do that?
Yes. Which is the dogs being chased?
Let me ask you this. Does the landowners in Jensen and the ORA area need to have some representatives go out to the meeting, or wait until the upland game?
I think that the best for them would be to wait until the upland game meeting. This would probably serve as a heads up to the Wildlife Board that we're really concerned here, and we're going to be addressing it, and we'll start their minds thinking about more here.
Hopefully they'll come back with something for it during that time frame.
They would want it at the appropriate time.
Yeah. Other discussion? Good motion, Joe. Thank you.
There's
thank
a motion, you. Right?
That was a motion.
A motion, okay.
Yes, do we have a second?
I'll second it.
That was Mitch Hacking, had a second.
I have a discussion on that.
Okay.
Because we asked that we get a explanation of how those permits are allocated. Can we have that presented in the May presentation? So when we're actually talking about the permit numbers, we'll understand it then.
Yep.
Have it presented in May?
Yes.
Or whenever the upland game.
The upland game.
Yeah, the upland. Yeah. Upland game. This is not upland bird, it's upland game in it. Other discussion? Does anybody know Ken Long or John Snow, I mean?
John Snow.
Well enough to call him and say, this is what we did afterwards?
I don't know him.
I do.
Do you know him? Call him. Would you mind letting him know that we had this discussion, we made a motion to get clarifications. He came here and presented us some documentation, and I think it's important that he know that we did a little bit more after he left.
Okay. Okay. I'll let him know.
Thank you, Andrea.
You'll still give me an app?
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
Do they not have a depredation program?
What was that?
Do they not have a depredation
program?
Yeah,
that's
what he's
going to
say.
No. They do some, and that we've been able to get, and most of this is done by the division, because they've gotten cannons, propane cannons out. But the problem is the birds become so accustomed that you can shoot a propane cannon off right next to them, and they don't move.
They don't fly away.
And so, we need to do it right now. I can't say anything more, or I won't say anything more.
Save the wild horses, huh?
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
Okay, we've got a motion.
I got a couple of years left, so I can't.
We got a motion and a second. We need a vote. All those in favor? 1, 2, Mitch says 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
To adjourn?
No, it was unanimous.
I'm the directive to this wildlife board.
Mitch wants to stay longer, is that what I'm hearing?
No!
Now you can.
We're having too much fun.
Tanya has a question.
Tanya, give you a presentation.
Well, I'll give you a presentation. I'm not going to be the same when we're done.
All right.
All those, are we ready to adjourn?
I motion that we adjourn.
We got a motion second.
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Let's the discussion.
Thanks, guys.
Yay!
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.